There you go. Okay. Well, good. It's so good to have you all here. Thank you. And this is an activity and an event that I've spent a great deal of time praying about and for you, not knowing who you actually were. So it's nice to see all the people that we've been praying for and asking the Lord to really do a work in all of our hearts as we spend not just this day, but this entire week together. In a variety of different settings, I realize that not all of you are going to be sitting in on workshops that I'll be doing, but you'll all be participating in a variety of activities, and I know that God's going to use this in a real significant way in your life. So I'm just honored to be here and honored to be with you today. Let's begin with prayer, and then I'll kind of give you a little bit of an introduction to who I am and how I ended up here, and hopefully that will be an encouragement to you, because I think most of us that serve in any kind of way in this profession that I have spent the last 35 years of my life working in, we never really intended to do that. It wasn't one of those things that in school, as an adolescent, you wrote papers about, this is what I wanted to do when I grew up. But it ended up being something that has been a very fulfilling means for me to be able to serve the Lord. And so I'm thrilled to be here. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for your goodness to us. Thank you for the privilege of being able to come to Chopron. And we realize that for many here in this room, it's been an arduous journey. Physically, all the way from Australia, it's a long way. For others of us, financially and from a time constraint standpoint, it was a real challenge to be here. Some probably have experienced a level of frustration and just transportation and border passings and all the kinds of things that are required in order to be able to get here. But we're here, and we believe that we're here because you have planned for us to be here. And we're in this room because you have had a part in directing us here. And Lord, I would pray that as we spend this time together today, that you would be ever present in what we say and what we do, that those things that we talk about might be incredibly relevant to the unique needs that we face in our individual ministries, that we might be able to leave here professionally challenged and encouraged, but more specifically that you would use these principles that have been proven to be effective in so many different ways, that you would use those principles to really impact our lives and our walk with you. And so, Lord, we just really commit this time to you and ask your blessing upon it, and we pray in the name of Christ our Savior. Amen. A little bit of background. For those of you that are familiar with the United States, I grew up in the northeastern corner of the U.S. in the state of Maine, which is a very picturesque area of America. I grew up in a family of fishermen, actually, in a little town in Maine called Kennebunkport. Now, that would probably not mean anything to most of you had it not been for the fact that the first President Bush had a summer home. He and his wife had a summer home in Kennebunkport, and so it became a bit of a focal point in American political history. So I lived in that town. That's where I was born. And on Christmas Day in 1944, I was a Christmas baby, and I showed up on the scene. We lived in a little section of Kennebunkport that is known among the people that live there as the Lower Village, and I suspect that it was a name that was ascribed to that area by residents who didn't look too kindly upon it, because it was just fishermen that lived there, lobstermen. The majority of people who live in Kennebunkport that fish for lobster, which is a delicacy that is enjoyed by many Americans. And so my father was a lobsterman, and my grandfather was a lobsterman, and my cousins are all lobstermen, and my uncles were lobstermen. I get horribly seasick. It just wasn't in the cards for me. I'm one of those guys that can go to the beach and watch the waves come in and then have to take a Dramamine or something just to be able to enjoy the experience. It's just not really a good thing for me. I went to college, to Bible college, in Miami, Florida. Now, again, for those of you that are familiar a little bit with the geography of America, there's a long distance between Maine and Florida, and it's warm in Florida, it's cold in Maine. So I'd like to say that all the reasons that I selected Miami were spiritual. But the first catalog I ever saw from Miami Bible College showed students underneath a palm tree next to the ocean studying the Bible. And I thought, well, this is obviously God's calling upon my life. So I went to Miami. And then I graduated from Miami Bible College in 1967 and went to Grace Theological Seminary. And at Grace, I majored in theology and apologetics and was basically carving out my career to be involved in probably pastoral ministry or maybe missions work. And so I graduated from Grace in 1970 and was invited to be on the faculty of a small Bible institute that was just getting established in the United States. And I went there and I worked there for 3 years. It was a brand new school. And so as a brand new school, we were having to do all the things that we do in development. We had to recruit students and we had to raise money. And it just so happened that I kind of migrated into that area. There weren't that many of us, and we all had to do something, and we found ourselves doing things that we weren't typically trained to do. And so I find myself doing that. I went back to Grace Theological Seminary in 1974 to do some postgraduate work. And when I was there, they asked me to serve in the development department. Now I have to tell you that I kind of felt that God had forgotten about me. I don't know what Moses felt like on the backside of the desert as he was tending his father-in-law's sheep, but I kind of felt that way. I mean, here I had gone to college and to seminary to train for ministry, and I was doing development, which I didn't necessarily construe as ministry, but I was reasonably good at it. I had a strong work ethic. My parents had taught us, the value of work and the importance of providing an honest day's labor for your employer. And so I worked hard and I was reasonably effective. But I was kind of miserable inside, always kind of waiting for that next opportunity, that next step that God had for me. Actually, when I was 15 years old, I'm going to back up a little bit because it really is relevant to my story. When I was 15 years old, I went to Bible camp. I think a lot of the decisions that I made in life that were really significant occurred when I was a teenager, going to camp and being challenged by speakers like yourselves that would come to camp and challenge us as youngsters. In 1960, I went to a campfire service. And at that campfire service, we were challenged. If we really wanted to commit our life to the Lord, we were challenged to come up to the campfire. There were about 450 of us in the service, and about 120 of us got up, and I walked down to the campfire. And we were invited to take a stick alongside the fire that was burning, and we were told that that stick represented our lives, and we were challenged to throw that stick into the fire and say, "Lord, whatever you want to do with my life, I'm prepared to do that." And I did that in 1960. And you know something? It was a very significant decision for me. I knew exactly what I was doing. I didn't know what it meant. I thought it probably meant that I was going to go to the mission field. And a lot of the decisions that I made from that point on in my life were predicated in many respects on that decision that I made that June day in 1960. Well, here I am doing development work, and I'm kind of thinking that the Lord had forgotten me and had forgotten that decision. And yet, I stayed there. And I was there for about 9 years. I was offered a position at another college in development, but it was in a different area of administration. And I thought, well, maybe that's a little bit closer to what it is that God would have me to do. And so I accepted the position. I sent a resignation letter to the president of the seminary where I was working, and lo and behold, about 2 days later, I get a call from him. He says, "I'd like you to come to my office." Well, I kind of knew why he was asking me to come. So I walked up to the office, and he invited me to sit down. He was sitting his desk, and he obviously had my resignation letter, in his hands, and he was kind of reviewing it, and he says, "Well, I see you're going to accept this position," and I said, "Yes," and he says, "Well, it sounds like a wonderful opportunity," and I said, "I think it is," but then he looked at me, he says, "We can't accept your resignation," and I was really surprised. I said, "Excuse me? I'm quitting." He says, "I understand what you're doing." He said, "But you signed a contract with us, and that contract is in effect until August of next year. And as far as we're concerned, that's a binding agreement." Now, he said, "If you want to dishonor God by breaking that agreement, that's between you and the Lord. But as far as we're concerned, it's a binding contract." And then he stood up. Well, when the president stands up, you just kind of assume the meeting's over, And so I remember walking out. He put his hand on my shoulder as I was walking out the door, and he says, "Well, I'm sure God's going to give you a great deal of wisdom here, Jerry, and what you should do, and we'll just pray that you'll make the right decision." And so I walked out of my office, and every wastebasket that I could see anywhere, I think I kicked it. And I walked down to my office that day. My office was in the basement, and I closed the door. And I got down on my knees, and I began to just sob. And I said, "Lord, I have absolutely no idea what in the world you're trying to do. Everything that I try to do to try to resolve my situation, to change it, to do things that I feel you'd have me to do, every one of those doors is slammed right in my face." And then I prayed. And I was just totally broken. And some of you can relate to those broken experiences. I think God gives them to us all. And it was an incredible time. I've kept a journal for probably the last 50 years of my walk with the Lord. I don't write in it every day. In fact, there's many days that I don't write in it. In fact, there's months that I don't write in it. And sometimes even a year goes by, but I've kept it. And I've kept it consistently, and as God really impresses something on my heart that I feel like I really must record, then I'll take that journal out and I'll write something. And that day I wrote something. Because as I prayed, I found myself praying something that I'd never prayed before. And in my journal that day, and you could almost see probably the teardrops on the journal page, I said, "Today I committed the problem to the Lord and not the solution." And it was really a turning point in my life, because most of my life I'd been committing solutions to God. Have you ever stopped to evaluate your prayer life and what it is that you're praying for? Oftentimes you're committing to God the solutions to your problems. "Lord, I just want you to bless me in this, and I want you to bless me in doing that." And I think probably God in heaven is hoping that maybe we'd just commit the problem to him and not the solution, our solutions. And so that day I just said, "Lord, I don't care what it is you want to do with my life, because obviously you've got a plan that's not consistent with mine, and I don't know what that plan is, but you know something? I'm not even going to worry about it anymore. It's yours. You do what it is you want to do with my life." But something happened that day, because it was like someone lifted a big heavy burden from my shoulders. And all of a sudden, I felt a peace that I hadn't experienced probably in years. And I walked home with a little bit of a spring in my step that day, and everyone recognized that something was different. And then I began to say, "Lord, if you want me in this profession, then I'm willing to do what it is that I need to do to be as good in it as I possibly can." And so I began to study a whole lot more and to think a lot more about some of the issues that I was grappling with on a day-to-day basis. And all of a sudden, I found myself beginning to enjoy what it is that God called me to do, rather than to look at it as a burden. And God began to bless my ministry in ways that went beyond my expectations and anyone else's expectations. Interestingly enough, about 2 years later, the president, who wouldn't accept my resignation, came down to my office and said, "I'd like to have you as a part of my administration team and our administrative team. And, would you be willing to do that?" And I said, "Well, I would." And during a 4-year period of time, we saw some dramatic things happen, at Grace College and Theological Seminary. During that period, we began, when I took that position, we were raising about $475,000 a year through fundraising activity. 4 years later, we were raising about $2.5 million a year. We saw a significant interest among people in terms of what it is that we were doing institutionally, and we received a lot of national recognition for things we were doing. You know, interestingly enough, the recognition that we received was not because we raised so much more money than we'd raised 4 years before, but it was because we raised that money from a database that hadn't appreciably changed over that same four-year period of time. In other words, we had 40,000 people on the database when we started. We had 40,000 people a year, 4 years later. But that same 40,000 people, and you know, was raising or were giving, you know, so much more in support of the institution. You know, I started that period of time by, first of all, looking at the database. And, you know, I noticed that there were a lot of names of people, many of whom I knew. And I'd kind of go through the database, and I noticed that many of those people that I knew weren't really engaged in the support of the ministry in ways that I thought were consistent with their capabilities. There's a perception development that what we need to do, if we wanted to raise $2 million, and we were raising $1 million, and we were raising $1 million with 20,000 people on our database, there's one approach to development that would basically dictate that, well, why don't we just increase our database from 20,000 to 40,000, because if 20,000 is generating a million, maybe 40,000 would generate 2 million, or whatever the case might be. But it occurred to me that we probably had all the resources that we needed right before us, and probably weren't doing necessarily a good job in developing those relationships to the extent that people would see the need for support financially and in other ways to support what it is that we were doing. And so rather than to reduplicate mediocrity, which I thought we would be doing if by increasing our database significantly, I decided to concentrate on the database that God had given to us and seeing if we could do a better job. Well, that resulted in some unique opportunities for me because our national recognition provided me a neat platform. I was beginning to be invited to go to universities and colleges around the United States and talk about the things that we'd done in that four-year period of time at Grace College and Seminary. And people were asking me to come and to help their organization. And so we began a bit of a consulting activity. And eventually I had more consulting activity than I could continue to fulfill and still maintain a full-time job. And so I left Grace in 1987. And began the company that I represent now called Development Marketing Associates, DMA. And DMA has worked with, you know, well over 3,000 organizations. I don't know how many it is. It was 3,000 about 10 years ago, so I guess it's probably more now. But in every state of the United States and many of the provinces of Canada to our north, and then several countries around the world. And it's been a real joy to be able to serve the Lord this way. So that's a little bit of background as to where I've come from. Let's talk about development. Now, I have provided you some notes, and I must say that I don't know what was in your notebook, but the notes that I'm going to be following for this session are those that are entitled the Preform Workshop, and there are the notes that are at the beginning of the packet of material that I've provided you. This is a seminar, kind of an introductory seminar that I often do in the United States and around the world. It's kind of an introduction to what it is that I spent the last 35 years of my life working on. I think you'll find it to be interesting and intriguing and hopefully very, very helpful and practical. And so we're going to, you know, kind of just cover the waterfront in a real general way in our time together today. And then as we move forward in workshops and in the network that I'll be doing, we'll be kind of going into greater depth and trying to address these issues more particularly. But let me begin by just giving you some definition. You'll notice that in these notes that have been provided, there are different modules. And essentially each one of these modules is kind of a different idea, a different thought that I wanted to develop. And so we're kind of bouncing around a little bit, but they all begin with a statement many times I've heard in conjunction with something, you know, that people would say to me as I come into their ministry. One of the statements that I've heard a lot is that we don't have any problems around here that, you know, $3 or $4 million wouldn't solve. If I've heard that once, I've heard it probably, you know, 100,000 times, I suspect, maybe not that much, but certainly thousands of times, you know, from people with whom I've had the opportunity of ministering. You know, essentially, they perceive their need as being a financial need, and that finances are going to resolve all their issues. And my contention is that that's probably not your really your main concern. And so I'd like to focus on just some basic introductions, some basic definitions, and so forth, so that we're all, you know, singing from the same sheet of music, so to speak. First of all, I want to talk about what development is. You know, what does it include? What are some of the things that we need to be concerned about in the ministries that we represent? And I think there are six broad areas that development tends to touch in terms of ministries. The first of those is fundraising. You know, we need to be concerned about raising money, don't we? Many of you have made reference to that in the context of your introductions. You know, we need money in order to be able to expand programs. We need money in order to be able to reach more people. We need money to be able to fulfill the broader dimensions of what it is that God's called us to do. And certainly, you know, that's important. In many instances, we have things that can't be done because we don't have the resources in order to be able to do it. Some of you have what I call traditional sources of income. You have perhaps tuition being paid, or people are paying fees for services that they're receiving from you. But those fees or tuition or traditional sources of income typically aren't sufficient to be able to fulfill the greater dimensions of what it is that God's called us to do. I mean, you have new programs that you would like to establish, and perhaps you need facilities in order to accommodate what it is that God's doing in your ministry and so forth, and so you need to raise money. And so fundraising is certainly an important part of what it is that we do. Oftentimes, when people hear the word development director, that's the first thing and the only thing that they think of. I periodically am introduced as a development person. It's always interesting to see people's responses. Here's Jerry Twombly. He's a development person, and all of a sudden, you notice that they step back about three steps, and you know, then all of a sudden, they find themselves kind of feeling around for where their wallet is because they want to make sure they know where it is. If there's a lady present, she's kind of reaching around for her purse, and you notice that her arm kind of goes over, you know, where the purse opens, and because they perceive you as being a fundraiser. And while fundraising is an important part of what it is we do, it's not all that development represents. Another area of development is what I call recruitment and retention. We need to recruit people to be engaged in the ministries that we represent. And we want to retain them. We want to be able to accomplish in their lives what it is our mission was committed to accomplishing in the lives of those individuals with whom we've committed ourselves to serve, or to whom we've committed ourselves to serve. So we need to recruit them. We want them to come in. We want them to be a part of what it is we're doing. You're recruiting volunteers. You're recruiting clients. You're recruiting a variety of different groups of people to become engaged in your ministry. And you want to retain them. Attrition is a real concern that most of you deal with. Student attrition, you have donor attrition, people who contributed to you 1 year that don't continue to contribute to you. You have attrition that's trackable, and that certainly is one way of being able to measure how successful you are in terms of your ministry. But recruitment and retention is an important part of what it is that we need to focus our attention on. You know, somebody that comes to you and is ministered by your organization over a period of time and leaves prematurely, we lose an incredible opportunity, don't we, to be able to minister to them in the ways that are consistent with our mission, what it is we've committed ourselves to do as an organization. A third area of development is public relations. You know, people have opinions about our organization. Maybe those opinions are accurate, maybe they're not. And that's really going to be dependent upon whether or not you've been involved in helping to shape those opinions. You see, there's two aspects of public relations. There's reactive public relations. Basically, we live essentially with a reputation that we have. It may be a good reputation, it may be a bad reputation, and we just kind of shrug our shoulders and say, well, that's the way they feel. And oftentimes, we're dependent upon how people communicate the nature of our ministry to others. You're always hopeful that that pastor or that Christian leader or that person in the community who is influential is saying the right things about you so that people are drawing the right conclusions, but sometimes they don't. And so it seems to me that it's important for us to be a little bit more proactive in public relations. In other words, determine the kind of image that we want, what it is that we want people to say, and make sure that, you know, as we dispense information about our organization, that we're communicating to people the things that they need to hear in order to be able to draw the conclusions that we'd like them to draw. I call that proactive public relations, and I think we need to be a little bit more proactive in the way that we represent ourselves to the constituencies that we serve. One of the things that we do a lot with organizations that we work with is public relations audits. We begin by creating a profile, a picture of the ideal, and then we look at absolutely everything that the organization does, from brochures to materials to things that people say when they go out representing the organization, and we kind of evaluate everything that is done in terms of how effective it is from a public relations standpoint and communicating what it is that people need to know about our organization in order to have the conclusions or to draw the conclusions that we would hope that they would draw in communicating our mission and ministry to others. There's a fourth area of development called database management. That doesn't even sound exciting, does it? I don't know if you're familiar with mincemeat. Is that a term that you'd be familiar with? Mincemeat pie? I guess I have a kind of a British background. My family, you know, immigrated to Canada initially from the UK. And so mincemeat, you'd probably, if you're from the UK or if you have UK roots, you'd be familiar with mincemeat. Well, I grew up, you know, close to my grandparents, and I grew up in a generation. It doesn't exist this way in America, and I suspect it's probably true in countries where you live as well. But, you know, 50 years ago, you know, everybody lived close by. I mean, grandma just lived down the road, and my aunts and uncles lived down the road, my cousins, they were all, you know, really, really close. Of course, now in America, you could have sons and daughters in different places all around the United States or around the world because we have so much more ability to be able to travel and so forth. But we all get together. We would all get together in our home and our family at Christmas time and at Thanksgiving, and we'd all, you know, have these wonderful meals together. And I remember, you know, being in my grandmother's dining room as the plates were being passed, and we'd fill them up and we'd eat, and then they'd come for seconds. And I remember as a little guy sitting next to my uncles, and the seconds were being passed around the table. We could take second helpings and things, and so my uncle was given the opportunity of getting a second helping of something that looked really, really good on the plate, and he says, "Oh no, I've got to save room for the mincemeat pie." Well, the plate would come to me, and I thought, well, gee, I probably ought to say the same thing because this mincemeat pie must be something, you know. And so I said, well, okay, I'm just going to save space for the mincemeat pie. Well, then the mincemeat pie came. I mean, that is atrocious stuff. I mean, you know, venison and raisins, they put a pie on it, and then they, you know, put a crust on it and, you know, give them a scoop of ice cream or something. And I'm thinking, why was anybody getting excited about this in the first place? I would have rather had a second helping of turkey or something, but... But I think, you know, for a lot of people, database management isn't very exciting. You know, we need to maintain data on those people with whom we're building a relationship, and we need the ability of being able to track where those people are in relationship to our organization and what it is proactively we're doing to move them from one level of relationship to another level of relationship. And that needs to be managed. You know, when I started in this profession 35 years ago, database management was 3x5 cards in a shoebox. That's the way it was. You know, if we're getting ready to go out and contact a prospective donor to our organization or someone with whom we were seeking to build a relationship, we'd usually go to the shoebox, and we'd go to the letter of the alphabet that represented the first letter of their last name. We'd find the card that had their name on it, and we'd kind of look at the card, and the card would have information on it that would help us to know a little bit more about that individual. We'd know where they lived. Oftentimes we would know the names of their spouse and children. And we'd know a little bit of their giving history, things that they'd given to. If they designated a gift to a specific area of ministry, we'd know that. That would be on that little card. And usually on the back side of the card, there'd be a little section called comments. And there'd be little pieces of information about that individual that would be helpful for us to know that they were, you know, especially interested in one particular area of ministry that our school was working with. Maybe it was, you know, the apologetics or the theology department or something, and that's where they had been designating gifts for years. And so it would help us to know a little bit more about them. Well, we'd go out and we'd have a meeting, and perhaps in the context of that meeting, they'd tell us a little bit more information about themselves and things that they were interested in. And so we'd run back to the shoebox when we got home, and we'd kind of make another little note that would help us to understand a little bit more clearly some of the unique needs and interests of those individuals. And well, that's the way it was done 35 years ago. But now we have computers. And the computer provides us the means of being able to track things a lot more efficiently, a lot easier, and to generate the kinds of reports that we need in order to be able to do the things that we need to do. And so database management is a very significant part of what it is that we need to be focusing our attention on if we're going to be doing development effectively. A fifth area is strategic planning. I heard many of you mention strategic planning in the context of your remarks here and introducing yourself. And we need to be planning for the future. Do you realize that 88% of all Christian ministries around the world don't have a strategic plan? That's a staggering percentage. 88% don't have a strategic plan. Many of them have, you know, a goal and a vision for where it is they'd like to see themselves. But when I define a strategic plan, I'm talking about something that states in quantifiable terms that things that would need to happen this year and next year and the years thereafter to bring us from where it is we are to where it is that we need to be. And quite frankly, if you don't have a plan that is quantified in that kind of way, it's probably nothing more than a good idea. You know, it would be a great idea if through our student ministry we could impact the lives of young people so that they could leave, you know, the university with a clear understanding of who God is and their role in His economy and how they might be able to integrate what it is they know about Him into the activities of life wherever those might lead them. And you know, it would just great if we could change the world through what it is that we're doing, you know, on the campuses of universities around the country in which we live. But if we don't have a plan to get that done, you know, that's quantifiable and measurable, the realities are, you know, that's just a good idea. It would be great if it happens, but the likelihood of it happening probably is really pretty remote. And so strategic planning is very, very important to the whole process of development. You know, my father, I don't know what your dad told you when you were growing up, but there's a phrase that is often used in America. And I remember my dad, when I was growing up, saying to me, "Son," he said, "if you don't have a target, you'll probably not hit it." And maybe your dad told you that. And, you know, you didn't even grow up in the same country that I did, perhaps. But I think, you know, our fathers did recognize that it was important for us to know what it is that we were going, what it is we were striving to accomplish. And if we didn't have a destination in mind, the realities are we'd probably not get to where it is that we wanted to go. And so most organizations, 88% of all Christian ministries don't have that kind of clear focus. Is it any wonder we're not having the kind of impact, you know, on the world that we'd really long to have if we don't have a plan? And then the last area of development that we're going to deal with is organization. You know, how in the world do we get it all done? You're going to get an idea or two in the context of our time together, and you're going to say, "Well, gee, that's a pretty good idea." And you're going to jot it down, and you might say, "Well, gee, I think we could probably do that in our organization." And so you kind of jot it down and say, "Well, that's a great idea." And then maybe a little bit later on in our presentation today, you'll get another good idea. And you say, "Well, that's a good idea too." And then you might get a third idea or a fourth idea or a fifth idea. And all of a sudden, you have idea overload. And you're saying, "You know, Jerry, I came into this seminar today. My plate was pretty full when I walked in here. And now, thank you very much, but you've just made it a whole lot heavier, a whole lot fuller. And now I'm essentially... have that much more to do that I didn't have time to do in the first place. And so, you know, thank you, but no thank you." And now, how do we get done? All these things that I'm talking about are necessary if we're going to be effective in fulfilling the mission to which we've committed ourselves. Well, I want to encourage you. And I hope this will be an encouragement. And for those of you that kind of hang in with me for the next 3 or 4 days, we're going to address some of these issues more specifically. But I just want you to know that there's not anything that I'm talking about here today that you can't do. And it would only require that perhaps you build relationships with maybe, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 people. That what we need to do is we need to learn how to leverage ourselves in meaningful ways to accomplish what it is that we've committed ourselves before God to accomplish. And organization is a part of the developmental process. So it's not just all about money. The realities are, you know, our ability to be able to raise the funds that we need in order to be able to fulfill the mission to which God's called us is going to be predicated on any number of factors, including, you know, recruitment and retention. If we have people walking out of our ministry at the same level, you know, that they're coming in, is that going to impact our ability to be able to raise money? No, of course it will. You know, we're told in America, I suspect it's true around the world, that the average dissatisfied customer, and we'll just call a donor a customer for the sake of illustration, that the average dissatisfied customer, that would be someone who gave to you last year who may not continue to support you for any number of reasons, and most often it will be because of some level of dissatisfaction. The average dissatisfied customer will share his dissatisfaction with about 15 people. The average satisfied customer will share it with about 3 to 5. And so you have, if you have huge attrition, donor attrition, client attrition, you know, volunteer attrition, whatever the case might be, when you have huge attrition, it does impact your ability to be able to raise funds more effectively. We need to be concerned about those issues. If people have the wrong impression about who it is you are and what it is that you do, public relationally, you're not doing the job, is that going to impact your ability to be able to raise money? Absolutely. If you don't know where people are in relationship to your organization, you know, that are on your database, and you try to treat them all generally like everybody's in the same relationship with the organization as the person next to them, is that going to impact your ability to be able to raise money? You bet it will. Or if you don't have a plan, oh, well, we've kind of got this general plan. We're going to be the best organization in our country in impacting college students. That's our plan. And if that's all you can deliver to people, the realities are it's probably going to impact the involvement of some that might be inclined to support you, but because they don't sense that you know where you're going, they're not going to put money in support of what it is that you're asking them to do. So all those things kind of fit together, don't they? But I didn't define anything about development. All I shared with you in those 6 points is the 6 things that make up development. But I'm going to give you some definitions now, and these definitions are pretty important, and they're going to be basic to where it is that we're going to go in the context of our time together here at Showprawn. The first definition I'd like to give you is the definition of development. You know, what really is development? Now I have to say before I give you that definition that I asked my first boss that question 35 years ago. I went into his office and, you know, I had accepted the responsibility, but I felt that I needed a little bit more clarification as to what it is I was supposed to be doing. I said, could you give me a job description? And he kind of looked mystified. He kind of scratched his head and said, job description? Like he'd never heard the question before. And so he kind of wavered a bit and kind of moved around a little bit in his chair, and then he finally said, well, raise money. So I'm taking a 3x5 card that I had with me, and I kind of wrote down raise money. That's my job description. And then I thought, well, I need to probably need a little bit more clarification here. I says, well, how much? And he kind of thought about it a little bit more and wiggled around in his chair a little bit more, and he says, well, a lot. And that was my job description, raise money and a lot of it. And yeah, let me tell you, that's pretty frustrating because, you know, how much is a lot? Some of you that have been in this profession for any length of time, have you ever seen the goal go down? You know, the annual goal go down? I've never seen it go down. It was always going up. And I might raise, you know, $1 million 1 year, and they'd say, well, you know, that's great. Next year's goal is 1.5. And, you know, I didn't get an awful lot of satisfaction out of that. And well, next year you need to raise two, and then we need to do this and that and the other thing. And all of a sudden I found myself feeling frustrated because I needed someone to tell me, you know, a little bit more specifically what it is that I was really supposed to do. You know, one of the things that you're going to know when you leave here is exactly what it is that you need to do. You will know how many donors you need in order to be able to accomplish what it is that God's called you to do. You'll know where those donors need to fall in a scale of the kinds of donors. I think there are broad categories of donors, and you'll need know how, you'll know specifically how many you need in each of those categories. And I would have given my right arm 35 years ago for someone just to have told me that. Because that's what I needed to know. That's what it is that you need to know. That's what it is that you came, many of you came wanting to know. How do we really get done what it is that God's called us to do? Well, that wasn't much of a definition. Let me give you a definition of development that I think you'll find to be helpful and effective. The definition goes like this, that development represents the things that we do within our organization to build rational relationships with others. Okay, let me repeat that. It's the things that we do within our organization, within the ministry that we represent, to build rational relationships with others. Now, if you're in the habit of underlining words or whatever that are of particular significance in the definition, then I would encourage you to underline the two words rational and relationships. Because those are the two operative verbs in the definition. And let's talk a little bit about relationships. Let me tell you something, that development is all about relationships, and it has very, very little to do with money. It's all about relationships. It's very little to do with money. Let me go on to say that development effective development is all about relationships and very little to do with what it is that you have to say. Now, and I speak at a lot of pastors' conferences around the world, and you know, pastors get a little uneasy when you make that statement because what they have to say is very important. Many of you are apologists as well as have a mindset towards development, and you realize that what it is that you have to say is very, very significant. But I'm here to tell you that effective development has a lot to do with relationships and very little to do with what you have to say. Now let me clarify that by making another statement. To the extent that you build effective, lifelong, meaningful relationships, you'll never lack for money. And let me take it one step further, and that is to the extent that you build relationships with others, you'll never lack an audience that will hear you. But when you lead with your need, whether that's the need to be heard or the need to raise money, when you lead with your need, you're almost always perceived as being manipulative. I've always been concerned about that. All of my career, I've been concerned about manipulation. You know, people have looked at me over the years. I've been critiqued by any number of people that have evaluated what it is that I'm doing and what it is that I say. And I've had people say, you know, Jerry, you're nothing more than a master manipulator. You can get people to do what it is that you want them to do. And you know something? That's like somebody putting a knife in my gut and turning it to do maximum damage, because that's not the kind of person that I want to be any more than I suspect that's the kind of person that you want to be. But I've had to evaluate that, as anybody in my profession has had to evaluate that question or that observation. I'm reminded of that passage in James chapter 2. You're all familiar with it. It's one of the verses or one of the passages of Scripture that people will frequently draw you to, where James says, "Do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism." He says, if someone comes into your assembly with a gold ring and dressed in fine clothes, and there also comes in a poor man dressed in dirty clothes, and you pay special attention to the one dressed in fine clothes, and you say, well, why don't you just sit here in this good place? You look to the one dressed in the dirty clothes, and you say, well, why don't you just stand over there or sit down underneath my footstool? And then I think the crux of the issue is brought to light in the next verse when James says, have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil motives? If the motive of pursuing an individual is just for what it is that they can give to you, then you probably have been manipulative.
And I think that's something that we just really need to address in our hearts as to really what it is that we're really trying to do. I am absolutely convinced that success in ministry, no matter how you measure it, is proportional to how effective we've been as an organization in building relationships with others. I'm not talking just about fundraising. I'm talking about effective church ministry, campus ministry. In fact, if you were to track your own life and the significant decisions that you have made in the context of your life experience, behind every one of those significant decisions, there's a face, isn't there? You know, maybe mom and dad or a Sunday school teacher or somebody who loved you and embraced you and came alongside and helped you and encouraged you and caused you to make some of the decisions that were very, very important for you to make in order to be able to do what it is that you've found yourself doing. And development is all about building relationships. Now, the challenge that we face is this. You know, how do you build relationships with 10,000 people or 100,000 people or 1 million people? You see, most of you know how to build relationships. You've been doing it on an individual basis all of your lifetime. I mean, if I were to come to your ministry and you were to recognize me as a guest or a visitor, someone who'd never been involved before, and you greeted me and you introduced yourself, and I have my wife Sue with me, and so we introduce our spouses to one another, and maybe on the way home from that encounter, you're driving and you look at your spouse and you say, well, you know, Jerry and Sue seem like a pretty nice couple. I'd like to get to know them better. You'd know what to do. You've been building relationships all of your life, haven't you? You'd know exactly what to do. You might invite me over for dinner. You might say, well, you know, let's get together someplace for coffee or espresso and sit down and talk some more. You might invite us to your home, or we might invite you to our home. But you know how to build relationships. You've been building relationships all your life. But the reality is, how do you build relationships with 50 or 100 or 200,000 people? One of our international clients, our company's international clients, is Habitat for Humanity. I think probably most of you are familiar with that organization. They're probably working in your country. Habitat for Humanity has engaged our organization to come alongside national and local affiliates. That's what they call their little agencies in various places around the world, to help them to raise the money that they need in order to be able to fulfill their mission. Well, I was attending a meeting not too long ago in Georgia. It's a state in the United States, and that's where the headquarters of Habitat for Humanity are located. And the president of Habitat for Humanity, his name is Millard Fuller, was talking to a group of people. I was just a part of that group. And he was saying, you know, we have a big database here at Habitat for Humanity. Well, I guess all of us assumed it probably was a pretty big database. It's the third or fourth largest charity in the world. And so you kind of assume that they probably have a pretty good sized database. And he says, we've got a lot of people on that database. And yeah, we probably figured that out too. And he says, would you like to know how many? Well, I was kind of curious, and I think everybody else in the room, we were all kind of nodding our heads. And he says, we have 2 million people on our database. Now, how do you build relationships with 2 million people? I mean, that's the challenge that we face. Now, actually, before the end of our session today, you'll have a pretty good idea how to do that. But we need to know how to do that if we're going to be effective in development. It's all about relationships. And I really believe that, you know, I've just written a new book. It's entitled Transforming Culture, The Church at Work in the World. And basically the purpose of this book was to try to point out that the principles of development that are so relevant to the way we live and function in the world and the way we function in life, these same principles that I'm presenting to you now need to be observed and practiced in the church. And to the degree that we have transformed churches, we're going to have transformed people. And to the degree that we have transformed people, we're going to have, you know, transformed culture. And it just seems to me that we need to think a little bit more developmentally. And so basically, all the book Transforming Culture does is it talks about a church. You know, I came to the conclusion, and this is a little bit of an aside, but there was an interesting article that appeared in magazines in the United States. I was traveling. I spend a lot of time traveling and speaking around the United States, and I was in an airport, and I was getting ready to go to my plane. It was going to be a long flight, and I walked up, and I saw a magazine sitting there on the magazine rack and in a newsstand, and it was a news magazine. A national news organization produces this magazine, and I noticed the headline on it. It said, "The New Evangelicals." It was a headline. That was the whole theme of that particular issue of the magazine that week. And I was kind of curious about it, and so I paid the $4 or whatever and picked it up. So I thought it was something I could read on the airplane as I was flying back home. And you know what that article said? Now, this is in America, and it's different in America than it is in the countries that you live, and I understand that. But in America, it said that 40% of Americans call themselves evangelical Christians. And I was kind of shocked by that. I made a little note. I probably underlined it. I thought, well, that's a pretty significant statement. And it occurred to me that we don't lack people in order to be able to impact culture. I mean, certainly if they're 40%, and I don't know how they were explaining or defining evangelical Christian. I suspect it was a rather loose definition. But nonetheless, you know, 40% of the people that were surveyed said, oh, yeah, that's what I am. And then as I drive around our country, and I realize that it's different in America, but when I drive around our country, I see a lot of churches. You know, I walk around Chopron, I see a lot of cathedrals and churches, and it occurred to me as I drive and as I was thinking about that article that we don't lack infrastructure in order to be able to really impact culture. We got people, we have infrastructure, and we certainly don't lack a redemptive message, a message that can really change people's lives. So what do we lack in order to be able to impact culture in the ways that I think God intended for us to do that? And you know what my conclusion was? That what we lack is we lack a plan, a meaningful plan, in order to be able to do what it is that God's called us to do, a salt and light in the world. And we lack an organizational infrastructure to get it done. And so the book Transforming Culture just takes all the principles that we're talking about here, and I'm going to give you a copy of it. We have it on CD so that you can all take it back with you, and as well as two or three other books that I've written. And it basically says, well, here's how one church did it. And it represents both the things that they did internally among members of their body as well as externally among people, you know, in the communities of which they were a part. But it's a challenge to churches to claim their communities for Christ. And I hope that God will use that. But relationships, it's all about relationships. And that's one of the things that we don't do really well. I don't think, you know, in America, I don't know what it's like in your country, but I think, you know, there's a real sense in which we try to guard ourselves against moving into relationships because there's a sense of fear that if we make ourselves vulnerable and then if we're rejected, then we're not going to be accepted anymore and our value is going to be lessened in the minds of the people with whom we want to most to be accepted by. And so, but relationships is very, very important. Now, the other term of that definition or the other word in that definition that's significant is the word rational. Now, let me suggest the antonym, if you please, for rational. I'd like to suggest to you that the opposite of rational in this particular context is emotional. In other words, we move into relationships through a portal of emotion. When you stop and think about, I think, by the way, a great analogy of development is falling in love. Remember falling in love? Some of you are older than others, and you know, all of a sudden, you know, you can almost hear the hard drives, you know, kind of spinning in your little computers. And, you know, bzzz, you know, I can remember, you know, meeting Sue for the very first time. I'm the youngest of three children. I have two older sisters. I was horribly abused as a child. Those of you that are youngest siblings, you can relate to that. But, you know, I have a sister that's 2 years older than I am, and my sister that's 2 years older than I am is always kind of taking care of me. I've kind of been, she's been my babysitter, you know, and, you know, all those crazy things. And so one day, as an adult, she calls me. And she says, now, Jerry, she says, I know that someday you're going to want to get married. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good observation. Yeah, I think you're probably right. Someday I think that would be a good idea. And she says, and I know that you'd like to, you know, find somebody that you could really cherish and love, And I'm just kind of on the other end of the phone as she's talking to me, saying, yeah, I think that's probably something that, you know, I'd love to do. And she says, well, I'm just calling you to tell you, you don't need to worry about it. And I thought, well, that was really sweet of my sister to call and tell me that, you know, that I didn't need to worry about it. And said, well, I thank you very much. I'm glad that I don't need to worry about that. But why? What would prompt you to say that? And she said, because I'm going to pick her for you. I said, well, I was kind of hoping I'd be a part of that decision-making process. She says, you're not smart enough. you're going to mess it up. And so you don't need to worry. I'm going to find this perfect girl for you. And, well, by this time, I'm so annoyed with her, I just kind of almost hung up the phone. I says, well, gee, thanks for your call. Really great hearing from you. You know, kaplunk. Well, you know, about 6 months later, she calls me on the phone. She says, well, I think I found the girl that would be just perfect for you. I says, oh, really? Well, tell me about her. And she says, well, her name is Sue. Now, you just heard me say earlier today that I married a girl named Sue, and it's the same one. She says, her name's Sue, and she's very, very intelligent. You know, she's got a doctorate in psychology. She's got a full-time practice in psychology. She's very well recognized. She's attractive. She's witty. Well, I'm just kind of sitting there saying, well, gee, this sounds kind of interesting. And I said, well, when are you going to introduce me to her? She said, oh, you're not ready for her. Well, now I'm really getting annoyed. I says, well, you know something? Will you just call me when you think I'm ready, you know, and then hung up the phone again. Well, about 3 months later, she thought I was ready. And so she calls me up. And she says, well, I want you to come to dinner. And she invited me to her house for dinner. And so I went to dinner, and I was there before Sue arrived, and the doorbell rang, and it was Sue, and I walked upstairs, and I saw her for the first time, and I can remember to this day what it is that she wore. She had braces on her teeth, and she had long, dark hair. She had an infectious smile, and she was witty. And she enjoyed a lot of the things as we talked, a lot of the things that I really enjoyed, and all of a sudden, I'm beginning to feel things that I've never felt before. I mean, I'm beginning to get rumblings in my stomach, and I'm getting a little flighty, and I'm thinking, well, gee, this is really something. Maybe my sister's got something here, you know? And so Sue and I started dating. Now, the point that I want to make is this, that it's emotion that brings us together in relationship. Emotion is the portal through which all relationships begin. People will become involved and engaged in your ministry initially because of the emotional appeal of what it is that you're doing. It's emotion that brings us together in relationships. It's rationalism that keeps us there. And that is a very, very important developmental point. It's emotion that brings us together. It's rationalism that keeps us together. My mother and dad are still living. My dad will be 90 years old in September. And my mother is 87 years old, and she's in a nursing home in the state of Maine. She has Alzheimer's disease. She's not known any of us for 10 years. The nursing home where my mother resides is about 5 miles or 6 miles from the farmhouse where my dad lives. I hate to go to Maine. I love to see my father. He's the person that I admire most in life. And I love to see my dad, but I hate to see my mother. It just hurts me to see my mother because this once vital person who was the incredible visionary behind a lot of the vision that I've ever had or I could claim in my life, she's probably responsible for. I just hate to see her because it just breaks my heart. She doesn't even know who I am. Well, I still make my quarterly trips to Maine. You know, it takes me about a month to get ready for that trip and about a month to get over it. But I take my trips to Maine and I get in the car with my father and I drive to the nursing home because every single day my dad goes to the nursing home. He drives the car to the nursing home and he gets out and he goes to the floor where my mother is located. And now, I have to give you a little bit of a description of Mom right now. She basically lays in bed. She doesn't even get out of bed anymore. And the false teeth that she has have long since been removed, and so she has real hollow cheeks, as you can imagine. She's lost a great deal of weight, and she hardly ever opens her eyes. And her mouth is almost kind of shut most of the time, and, you know, kind of dry, and she'll drool a little bit. And so you go into the hospital room, and there's Mom. And I'm just sitting there observing, okay? And I watch my father. And my father goes, and The first thing that he does is he goes and he gets a washcloth and he puts some water on it and a little bit of soap, and he'll go and he'll wipe her mouth, you know, where she's drooled, and there'll be some drainage in her eyes because her eyes are almost shut permanently now, and he'll wipe the, you know, make the drainage away. And then he'll reach down and kiss her and he'll tell her how much he loves her and kind of holds her a little bit and coddles her. And then he'll go back and get the food. Now, it's just baby food. You know, it's just all food that's been ground up because she can't chew anymore. She can't, you know, so it's just baby food. And so he'll taste it, you know, with a baby spoon. And just to see if it's not too hot or too cold. And then he does something which I think is kind of sweet. He takes a little bit of salt. He just puts salt all over it. My mother just loves salt. And everything, I mean, no matter, I mean, it was typical in our house that if something came to the plate, you know, she just put salt on it without ever tasting it, you know. She just had needed salt. And so he puts a bunch of salt on it. And then he'll feed her. And after he feeds her, he'll wipe her mouth. And then he'll just sit there and hold her hand and talk to her. And he'll do that for 10 or 15 minutes. And then he'll reach down and hug her again and hold her and kiss her. And they say, well, I'll see you tomorrow, honey. And he'll walk out. Well, you know, you have to understand, I'm sitting there. And you can imagine, you know, sitting there. I hopefully have drawn a picture that would cause you to kind of imagine what sitting there would be like. And I'm just sitting there, you know, thinking, I have no idea how he does this. And we get in the car, and he's driving, and I'm just sitting there, and I can't even talk. Well, we drive down the road a little bit, and we pull into the driveway. It's a long driveway that goes up to the farmhouse where my dad lives. And I haven't said a word. And finally, I feel like I need to say something. And so as we're getting ready to stop the car, I finally look at my dad, and I say, you know, Dad, I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you do this every day. Now, my dad is kind of short. He's a fisherman. He was a lobsterman. It would take a chainsaw to cut his skin. I mean, it's just like leather, you know. And there's nothing about my dad that would cause him to stand out. I mean, he just looks like another person from Maine that's lived all of his life by the ocean. And he gets out of the car. And he's got the door open. He's obviously thinking about what I said. And he kind of puts his one foot down. He's getting ready to step out of the car. And he kind of looks at me and he says, you know, he said 70 years ago, they just celebrated their 70th wedding anniversary. He says, 70 years ago, I stood in front of your mother in your grandparents' living room. And that's where people were married 70 years ago, in the parlor at grandma's house. And he said, I looked at your mother and I said, in sickness and in health, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, sickness and in health, until death do us part. And then he reaches his other leg and he's getting ready to go out of the car. And he stands up and he looks in and he says, and I meant that. And he closed the door. I mean, imagine. We're talking about rationalism, aren't we? He says, I meant that. That was a choice that I made. And I meant it. And he's lived his life exemplary in so many wonderful ways as it relates to his commitment to my mother. I have never, in my years of life, I have never heard my father speak anything but admirably about my mother. I've never heard him raise his voice to my mother at all, ever. He's been such an extraordinary example in so many ways. Well, my sisters, those rascally sisters, my sisters are getting concerned about Dad. You know, for the last 10 years, he's been doing this and faithfully. And so they decided they were going to put together a scrapbook of all the memories. And my mother had taken all these pictures and, you know, that they'd gathered over the years, and she'd put them in drawers and cupboards and boxes. And so my sisters go on this excursion around our farmhouse to try to find all these pictures, and they put them into a lovely scrapbook. And you're familiar with these kinds of scrapbooks. And they gave it to my dad. They wanted my dad to remember what life was like, you know, over the years with Mom. And that scrapbook sits on the coffee table right in front of the sofa in our living room. I looked at it not long ago, and I noticed that the first picture in the book is one that was taken over 70 years ago. It's Dad and Mom before they were ever married. And they're standing on a mountain. And my mother is looking up at my father, and teenagers would say, oh, that's disgusting, you know. She just has got this look of incredible admiration on her face. It's like, this is King Arthur. You know, he just kind of rode in on the white steed, you know, and hey. And so she just has this look of, it's a combination of admiration and awe, you know, on her face. And my dad is kind of looking down, and he has this, you know, this grin on his face. It's kind of disgusting, too, I guess, in some respects. And he's acting like, you know, this is Cinderella, you know, the glass slipper fit. I mean, you obviously can see the picture just sends out incredible messages of love and commitment and admiration. It's just a great, great picture. And I think about Mom and Dad, you know, 70 years they've been married. They've been through a depression. They've been through two world wars. They lost a child about 3 days after the child was born. They've been through financial crisis and disaster. And I mean, you name it. I mean, they've experienced it in the context of their 70 years together. Now they're going through this period of their lives. And, you know, but you know something, when you see Dad, you know, with my mother, the emotion's still there. But what's kept them together all that period of time is that commitment that he was reflecting when he said, I meant that. Now let me just tell you that's the kind of supporters that you need for your organization. These lifelong supporters who you know, are emotionally drawn to what it is that you do, but despite the fact that you're going to not always do things right as an organization. You know, you're going to make some mistakes, but you need people who are so rationally committed to what it is that you've committed yourself to do. They've locked arms with you and saying, you know, for better or for worse, we're going to stick together, and by God's grace, we're going to accomplish what it is that He's laid upon our hearts to do. That's the kind of support that you need. And that's what development's all about. It's generating that kind of support. And the process is called development, and the process involves building rational relationships with others. That's what development is. It's building relationships with others. And we're going to share with you how you can do that effectively. Now, there's three other definitions, and then we'll kind of get down to some of the real specifics of what it is that we're here to talk about today. But here's another definition, successful development. You know, how do you measure success? You know, success is measured in a lot of ways. It seemed to me that when I was actively involved at the institutional level in development, that success was measured in terms of how much money you raised. You know, well, you know, $2 million, that's not too bad, Jerry, you know, and pat on the back, and, you know, it's 2.5 next year. And so they just kind of walk out of the room. But it seems like in a lot of ways that success is measured in terms of dollars and cents. And I think that's probably valid. I'm not suggesting that it's improper, but I think there are a lot of other ways to measure success. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later on. But I would like to suggest to you in the context of this definition that successful development is measured in terms of the ability of an organization to sustain the involvement of constituents. In other words, what you need is not just people that are giving to you today, but people who will lock arms with you for a lifetime. People who will come alongside and be a part of what it is that you're doing and engage with you in what it is that you can't do alone, but together, collectively, you can make a huge difference in making impact upon the world in which we live. Now, there are two other definitions that I think are relevant to this whole discussion. One is what I call the annual fund. Okay, the annual fund. And I'm defining the annual fund as the things that we do on an annual basis to raise the money that we need annually to get done what it is that we couldn't do without that money. In other words, most of you have a need that you need to fund annually. You may have income coming in from a variety of sources, but that probably is not sufficient in order to be able to accomplish the broader dimensions of what it is that God's called you to do. And so you need to raise money. And you have a budget this year. Maybe that budget is to raise, you know, a certain amount of dollars or euros or whatever the case might be, the currency of your country. But you need to do that, and you realize that you need to do that in order to be able to fulfill the broader dimensions of what it is that God's called you to do. And so my suggestion to you is that you call it the annual fund. Give it a, you know, give it an identity. You know, for years I've suggested to organizations that you give your annual fund a name. Maybe it's building hope, you know, for the future. I mean, that's a little weak, but nonetheless, you're getting the point. But, you know, you have a theme. I would suggest that you maybe go to a graphic artist that's a part of your constituency and give them that theme and say, well, can you create a logo? you know, for our annual fund this year. You know, give it an identity, something that people can relate to, and maybe use that logo in your newsletters or your stationery for that given year, so that everybody knows that you know, building hope and building lives 2004, 2005 is essentially your annual fund appeal for this year. So give it a name and give it an identity. Here's another suggestion that I would recommend that you give consideration to making the predominant focus of your annual fund appeal restricted to a relatively short amount of time, maybe 6 to 8 weeks, where you're making a real strong public appeal to fund your goal for this year's annual fund. Now, that doesn't mean that you wouldn't accept money prior to that time and after that time. All the money that's raised during that particular fiscal year would go into funding your annual fund goal, but there would be a specific period of time, maybe a 6 to 8 week window, where you go to donors and prospective donors and you invite them to come alongside and be a partner with you in helping you to accomplish what it is that God's called you to do. I don't know if it's true in your country. In America, it's quite true. And, you know, there are certain organizations that raise money every year at the same time of year. We have the Salvation Army, and I suspect that that's probably national or international. But at the Salvation Army, you know, who would you expect to see out in front of a grocery store or a department store, you know, ringing a bell long about the 1st of December? You'd expect probably to see someone from the Salvation Army, because that's when they raise the predominant amount of money that they need annually to fund their annual fund need. Now, they raise money throughout the year, and all that money goes into their annual need, but they have a specific time of year where people's minds and hearts and attention is drawn to the Salvation Army and its work, you know, in the various ways it provides its services in communities around the world. And so there are a lot of organizations that do that. You probably can think of many, you know, in the area of the world that you live in. Well, the point is that if you have an annual fund, you want to communicate to people that you have annual needs and that you will be appealing to them for that annual need at a certain time every year. And as time goes on, people will just expect it. Oh, yes, it's November. Oh, and November is when we get the appeal from the student union to come alongside and to be a part of what it is that God's doing in that ministry. And so everybody kind of prepares mentally and psychologically for the appeal that's going to be given in terms of your annual fund that year. A lot of organizations will have, you know, honorary chair people, people of prominence that are associated with the organization to serve as chairmen or chair ladies in relationship to certain groups of people. In other words, maybe you're going to work with, you know, one focus of your annual fund is going to be focused towards medical professionals, you know, who have been supporting your ministry for years. And so maybe there is a prominent doctor in the country or in the region that would be willing to say, well, I'll be happy to be the honorary chairperson for, you know, that division of the annual fund. And so things that go out on behalf of the organization go under his signature. And essentially what he's doing by his participating in this way is lending his endorsement of your ministry and what it is that it's doing and the fact that it's worthy of consideration for those people that might be considering supporting you. So the annual fund, the things that we do annually to raise money annually, my suggestion is give it a name, you know, give it an identity, you know, have a particular period of time in which people, you know that they're going to be invited to come alongside and support and make commitments to your annual need. And I think that might be important for you and something that you might want to consider. Now, the fourth definition that I'd like to suggest to you is what I call the capital fund. Now, I realize that many of you may never go into what I call a capital fund campaign. Some of you may, and I think probably all of you know what it is that I'm talking about. But periodically, organizations will go into a capital fund campaign to raise money over and above what it is they need to raise annually to fund those larger initiatives that otherwise would never get funded. If you're a church, and if you're a growing church, periodically you'll know that churches will go into capital fund campaigns, because generally that capital fund campaign is designed to raise money to build a new sanctuary. Well, the realities are the church couldn't build that sanctuary, the church couldn't build that new church building apart from an influx of money over and above what it is they're raising annually through tithes and offerings. And so churches, and this happens quite often in America, and perhaps in your area of the world as well, that churches will periodically go into capital fund campaigns. Many organizations will do it. And essentially, the only difference between a capital fund campaign and an annual fund campaign is amortization. You see, in an annual fund campaign, people are basically making commitments, pledges, if you please, that they intend to satisfy during that particular fiscal year. In a capital fund campaign, people are making commitments, pledges perhaps, that they intend to satisfy generally over a longer period of time, oftentimes 2 or 3 or 4 years. In other words, you're giving them a longer time to satisfy what it is they commit to do financially. And what it is they commit to do financially is generally over and above what it is that they're doing annually. In other words, they're making this extra commitment to help you to get the jump start that you need in order to expand ministry and hence reach more people with the message that is so relevant to your organization. So that's the capital fund campaign. Interestingly enough, the amount of money that you can raise in a capital fund campaign is pretty predictable. I can probably tell you within plus or minus 10% the amount of money that you could raise if you went into a capital funding campaign. It's not all that difficult to do. And there's a rule in capital funding that goes something like this. Just listen to the rule. I think you'll find it to be very, very intriguing. I'll give you the rationale for the rule in just a few seconds. But the rule goes something like this, that you shouldn't go into a new capital funding campaign within 5 to 7 years of the previous one. Now, just listen to the rule and let me kind of repeat it again, that you shouldn't go into a new capital fund campaign within 5 to 7 years of the previous one, which essentially assumes that there's a cyclical nature in which these capital funding campaigns are oftentimes introduced in the lives of organizations. And you know, interestingly enough, why it's 5 to 7 years? Because a developmental generation is typically about 5 to 7 years in duration. In other words, if you continue to do development well on an annual basis, every 5 to 7 years you have more new people than you had old people. In other words, you continue to sustain and retain those older, long-term supporters, but if you're doing development well and having the annual increases that we think you should expect developmentally within an organization, every 7 years you have more new people than you have old people. And hence the opportunity to go and to present to them the greater dimensions of what it is that God's called you to do. Now, interestingly enough, and I only want to share this with you because I think it's intriguing. This is a diagram that I've used a lot to try to define or describe this scenario. Kind of looks like this. Okay, each one of these steps represent a year. This is year one in this particular case. This is year two. This is year 3, 4, and 5. This is assuming that this organization goes into a capital funding campaign, that people are presented the opportunity of amortizing their contribution over 3 years. Okay? And so, you know, giving, if these incremental steps represent just giving alone, then essentially giving goes up during this 3-year period of time because people are satisfying pledges. But when that campaign is over, giving goes down. But interestingly enough, it never goes down as low as when it started. In other words, you could realistically expect a 30% increase in every, what I call, leading developmental indicators. All the indicators that we use to assess developmental health. And it's not just fundraising. In other words, you know, there are a variety of what I call leading developmental indicators. One developmental indicator is the size of your database. You know, that's one way of being able to measure developmental health within an organization, is how big is the database. There's another way of being able to measure developmental health, and that's by the number of donors that you have on an annual basis. How many donors contributed to you last year? And you should be showing at least minimal, I think, 10% increases in each one of these. There are 6 leading developmental indicators, and we'll talk more about them a little bit later on. And so let's say, for the sake of illustration, just to carry on this illustration, that an organization could raise, we'll use U.S. dollars just because that's the currency in which I'm most familiar, but let's say that an organization could raise, you know, $3 million U.S. dollars during a capital campaign. In other words, we have gone through some assessment. We've kind of evaluated certain things, and we've been able to say, well, we think you can raise $3 million. Let's just say that for the sake of illustration, okay? So here's an organization that raises $3 million. In 5 to 7 years, remember the rule is that you shouldn't go into a new campaign within 5 years of the beginning of the previous one? So here you've got 5 years. You've got the beginning of this campaign. So 1, 2, 3, and then you've got these 2 years here. So 5 years, this organization could theoretically go into another campaign. And interestingly enough, during that next campaign, they should be able to raise 60% or more of what it is they raised in the first campaign. So in this particular example, they should be able to raise 60% of 3 million is 1.8. So they ought to be able to raise about $4.8 million during that window of opportunity. And during this next window of opportunity, they should be able to raise close to $8 million. So here's an organization over 15 years, that's the span represented by the chart in front of you, could raise close to $16 million over and above annual funding needs. Now, the reason that that's important is because it becomes the basis of a lot of planning. Remember I said that 88% of all organizations don't plan? You heard that statement, didn't you? And you know why they don't plan? If you were to ask them, why don't you plan? Why don't you have a strategic plan for your organization? You know what most of them would tell you? We did that once. And then they'll begin to tell you about the experience, you know, their strategic planning experience. They said, oh, yeah, we did that once. I remember that. And then they'll start talking about the plan. And if you ask them to see the plan, they said, oh, yeah, we can show you a copy. And then they look around for 20 minutes or half an hour or maybe 2 hours to try to find the plan. But eventually they find it. And they bring it to you. And it's one that's kind of dusty. You kind of have to wipe off the dust because it's not something that's been very, you know, used at all. And they said, well, that's our plan. And the reason it's not been used is because it was totally irrelevant. From the very moment it was created, it was irrelevant. And it was irrelevant oftentimes for one reason. And that was that it was created in a financial vacuum. See, this organization had no idea what it is they could raise, and so they create a plan that's some kind of a grandiose plan that has a huge dollar sign attached to it, or a pound sign, or a euro sign, or whatever. You know, it's got a huge amount of money attached to it that the organization, practically speaking, has no capability whatsoever. Practically speaking, I realize that God can do anything that he wants to do, and I certainly don't deny that, and I believe that with all of my heart. But I have learned that oftentimes God does work within structure. And when organizations have been irresponsible in building or not building infrastructure to support, you know, the future, you know, that typically, you know, they're not successful in going into capital funding campaigns. And so what happened is that this organization, you know, that created the plan created an irrelevant plan because it was created in a financial vacuum. But assume for the sake of illustration, that you knew, practically speaking, that in the next 15 years, your organization had the capability of raising $16 million. And so now we create a plan that basically says, if we had $16 million available to us over the next 15 years, how could we use that to further the cause of Christ to which we've committed ourselves to as an organization? If we could raise $3 million, what could we do? What could we do now that we haven't been able to do? And if we could raise, you know, another $5 million 5 years from now, what could we do there? And then create plans that essentially have the likelihood of succeeding because they've been built on a stronger foundation.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like you develop an operating plan back solving.
Exactly.
What would that cost?
Well, you could do it both ways.
Forward and say, what would that cost?
Well, actually,
start from the end back and say, what is that the scope to do?
Well, I think there are two answers to that question. I mean, one is that you could do it this way. You could project forward what it is that you could raise over the next 15 years. Now let me give you another illustration. Not long ago, I was invited to go to a major university in America. It's a university that most of you would recognize, Christian University. And they asked me to come and to provide some counsel to them, and so I was happy to do that and went with them and to them. And
actually, I just did this last week with another college, which probably is a little bit more relevant because it just happened last week. Here was a college that I went to last week, okay, before I flew out here, that the president of the college said, we need to be in a position in 10 years to raise $500 million. Can you tell us what it is that we need to do this year and next year and the years thereafter to prepare ourselves for what we know is coming in 10 years? And then he had some short-term issues that needed to be addressed as well. And so that's the other way to look at the situation is to say, you know, if we're going to be effective over the next 20 years in accomplishing the mission, you know, to which we've committed ourselves, it's going to cost X number of dollars, then you can back into that what it is that you need to do this year, next year, and the years thereafter to bring you to that point where you could raise that amount of money. So it doesn't have to be this way. This is one way to look at it. You can back into it another way as well. And I'll work through those formulas and scenarios for you in the context of our time together this week. Okay? So those are definitions. Let's kind of repeat them again. Then we'll let you stand up. We have a break coming at 3, so that's 45 minutes. And if you need to get up and, you know, you don't have to stay here and be uncomfortable if you need to get up. So please, no one's going to point their finger at you and say, aha, you know. All right, 4 definitions of development. Development represents the things that we do organizationally within our organization to build rational relationships with others. We need to build relationships. It's all about relationships, and I really believe that. I believe that the impact of ministries is predicated in a very significant way upon the ability of an organization to be able to build relationships. And think about your life. Think about the decisions of life. You know, there's people behind those decisions, people that loved you and cared for you and responded to you when others ignored you, and they came alongside and encouraged you and gave you the courage to be able to do oftentimes what it is that you may be doing today. So our life is a story of relationships or a lack of them. We could probably tell the adverse side of that equation as well. Okay, so development represents the things that we do to build rational relationships. Number 2, successful development is measured in terms of sustainability. The ability of an organization to be able to sustain the involvement of constituents. But number 3, the annual fund are things that we do annually to raise the money that we need to raise annually in order to be able to get done what it is that we can't do through just traditional sources of income, if in fact we have any of those traditional sources of income. Some of you depend totally upon gift income in order to be able to do what it is that you need to do. Others of you have sources of income that you could expect and anticipate, but you need to build on that in order to be able to fulfill the greater dimensions of what it is that God's called you to do. And then the 4th one is the capital funding campaign, things that happen periodically. I am convinced that there is a capital funding campaign in most organizations' future. Because the realities are that we typically have dreams that go beyond our capability of being able to fund, you know, outside of an influx of money periodically to support what it is that we do, to expand what it is that we need to do. And so I think there is a capital funding campaign in most of your futures. And the point that you need to remember is that what it is that you're doing now is posturing yourself for that inevitable funding campaign. If you draw the conclusion that there is a campaign in our future, then what it is that we do now is really posturing ourselves for our ability to be able to accomplish that goal. And so, you know, unfortunately, and this happens all the time, and it happens in my profession, in what it is that I do, that most of the organizations, you know, all of a sudden they realize, well, we need to have some kind of a major funding campaign if we're going to be able to take advantage of the great opportunities that God's given to us. You know, that's the only thought that they've put into it. You know, that's 3 months before it's supposed to be launched. And now we're supposed to try to, you know, build infrastructure when we failed to do it all along. Well, you can do it now and be virtually, as much as you can guarantee anything in this profession, be virtually guaranteed that you can raise what it is that you need when you need it in order to get done what it is that you need to do. And that's the way I think development needs to be done in the context of the ministries that we represent. See, I look at development as a stewardship issue. And I realize that, you know, that's probably something that we haven't thought about before, but it seems to me that when Paul was writing to the church at Thessalonica, he says, you've been entrusted with the gospel. There's an insurance company in America, you know, and perhaps if you've traveled in America, perhaps you've seen their advertisement, but it's called Allstate Insurance, and their logo
is somebody standing, you know, and all you see is the hand, and you see they sell homeowners insurance. And so there's a house in somebody's hand. And their theme is, you're in good hands with Allstate. That's the theme of this insurance company. You're in good hands with Allstate. Do you think that, you know, God would look at your organization and say, you're in good hands with, you know, XYZ organization? In other words, have we been good stewards of that which has been entrusted to us? Because I believe that if you're in the role of responsibility and administration of an organization that you represent here today, then you have a stewardship responsibility. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, moreover, it is required of stewards that a man be found faithful. And I think, you know, I look at development as a stewardship issue, that we can't ignore, you know, this core basic thing that is going to enable us to accomplish what it is. And I don't see it just as fundraising. I mean, if we did nothing, if you left with nothing more this morning or this afternoon with the fact that development is all about building relationships, and you decide that, okay, you know, that's something that we don't do. We preach the word. I mean, there are a lot of pastors that preach the word, and there's nothing wrong with their message in terms of its, you know, what it is that's being said. It's exegetically, you know, totally right on. You know, it's apologetically strong. You know, it defends the faith in ways that are consistent with what it is that the scriptures teach. But there's no impact. You know, and why might there not be impact? You know, might it not be because of our failure to really build the kinds of relationships that cause people to respond to truth? So those are some developmental, we talked about the annual fund campaign, the capital fund campaign, you know, what it is we do periodically. There are three reasons, and we're just about ending this boring introduction, and I apologize, but, you know, it seems to me that you can't start talking about development until you really know what it is we're all talking about, so that we're all on the same sheet of music. But there are three reasons why people will sustain their support of your organization. Three reasons. And let me tell you what those reasons are. The first of those reasons is that they know your mission. Let me just suggest to you that your mission statement as an organization is the essence of rationality. If you want to know what your organization is, you should be able to point people to your mission statement. This is what it is. This is who we are. This is what it is that we do. Habitat for Humanity has an interesting mission statement. It goes something like this, that we work in partnership with God and people everywhere from every walk of life to build and renovate homes so that and to create community so that people can become all that God intended for them to be. That's their mission statement. So if you want to know what Habitat for Humanity is, well, they work in partnership with God and people everywhere from every walk of life to build and renovate houses, to create community so that people can become all that God intended for them. That's who they are. So people will support you because they know your mission. Number two, they'll support you because they believe in that mission. That's important. You know, basically what it is that this organization is doing, I find very, very important. And then the third reason why they'll support you, and this is the key, this is the crux of the whole thing. The third reason why they'll support you is because they are irrevocably convinced that you can do what it is that you say you're going to do. In other words, there's confidence in your organization and its ability to accomplish this mission. If they don't have confidence in what it is that you've committed yourself to do, they will not continue their support of you. Now, I think that argues a little bit for the importance of public relations, does it not? That what it is that we talk to people about is not just our mission, not just our vision, but we talk to them about the people who've been impacted. We start anecdotally telling the stories of people that have come into our ministry that had lacked hope and they'd lacked direction and they'd lacked the things that our ministry provides. And we've come alongside and we've been a part of their lives and they've since left and they're out serving God today because of, and most of you have many of those stories that you could tell, and you need to tell those stories because it builds confidence among people that you can do what it is that you say you're going to do. Now, one final thing, and we'll take a little bit of a time for questions, and we can stand up a little bit because they're not ready for our refreshment until 3, and so we can kind of
shuffle around a little bit if you need to. But there are four things from my perspective that are essential to successful development. And these are things that every one of your organizations need to address. And I think they're best represented in a triangle here. So I'm going to create a triangle, and hopefully you can see it. Let me use a darker pen here. And there are four things that every organization needs to clarify if it's going to be successful in development and successful in general. First of all, mission. Mission is absolutely foundational to everything that we do. It drives everything that you do within your organization. If you're a student organization, it drives the curriculum. You know, what it is that we're going to share with students this year. If you're a student organization, it drives some of the extracurricular and co-curricular programs that you provide outside the curriculum, opportunities for students to become engaged in meaningful ways consistent with your mission so that you can accomplish things that you've committed yourself to do. I mean, that's some of the things that we do. Everything that we do, be it our newsletters, be it the content of what it is that we say and special activities and meetings and opportunities that we stand before individuals interested in our organization, everything is driven by mission. Now I might say that mission statements in most organizations are kind of afterthoughts. Let me explain. In our country, there are two reasons why organizations produce mission statements. You know what they are? Number one is that they need to have a mission statement in order to be incorporated. In other words, if you're going to be incorporated in America as a nonprofit organization, you have to have a mission statement. So people, you know, put a mission statement together. The other reason why typically mission statements are required is for accreditation purposes. If you're a college or a university or if you're a Bible school or certain other kinds of ministries are oftentimes accredited by an outside agency and they have to show evidence of a mission statement. Well, you know, it wouldn't be unusual for me to get a phone call at our offices. And somebody might call and say, well, Jerry, you know, we're such and such an organization. We're going through this particular process right now organizationally. And could you send me some sample mission statements? Well, years ago, I used to send them. You know, I'd fax, sure, I'll fax you some over. And so I fax them over. And, you know, a few months later, I get a brochure from this organization. I kind of look at it, and there's a mission statement. I think this looks decidedly like one of those that I sent them. And so I noticed, well, it's exactly like the one that I sent them. And so I called them on the phone. I said, well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I got your brochure, and it's a lovely brochure, and I noticed that your mission statement's in the brochure, and it's decidedly like one of those that I sent you. They said, well, no, Jerry, it's exactly like the one you sent me. I said, we kind of liked it. It sounded nice. It kind of flowed right. It just sounded, everybody that read it kind of felt warm and fuzzy about it. And so we called that organization. We asked them for permission to use their mission statement. They said, oh, yeah, you could use it. And so they just reproduced it. They don't own that mission statement. And what I mean by owning it is that mission statement is not uniquely theirs. And it has very little relevance to what it is that happens on a day-to-day basis in that organization. It just sounds good. And let me tell you, so mission, you know, needs to be more relevant than that. It needs to drive virtually everything that we do within our organization. Now, up here at the peak of the triangle, we'll put a cloud, okay? And on that cloud, we're going to just write the word vision. Vision. And let me, I have an equal sign here, okay? Because vision equals mission accomplished. And what I mean by that is simply this. If your ministry, and I think it's very, very important that you define this and articulate it. And that is, if you were 100% successful in accomplishing what it is that God's called you to do as an organization, if your mission was 100% successfully accomplished in the lives of the people with whom and to whom you minister, you know, what would they look like? In other words, what does the fulfillment of the mission look like? See, vision equals mission accomplished. You know, what would people look like who've been impacted by your ministry? What would they be doing? How would they be living? How would they be functioning in their world? And that's the vision for what it is that you do. And let me just give you a suggestion when you're talking to people. You know, lead with your vision. Lead with your vision, not with your need. Lead with a vision.
Let me tell you what it is that we're about as an organization. Let me tell you what it is that we're seeking to do. We're seeking to produce a new generation of graduates from universities in the United Kingdom. A new generation of graduates who go out into their world and they're able to do these things. And we see, you know, 20 years from now or 30 years from now, you know, entire industries and groups and organizations impacted by this group of students that are going out. And that's what we see, and that's what it is we're committed to doing. And, you know, share that vision. You know, it's vision that captures the imagination of people, not needs. It's vision. One of the organizations we've had the privilege of working with over the years has been Campus Crusade for Christ. And, you know, we lost a great visionary in Bill Bright. Many of you knew Bill and at least knew about him. Bill Bright was the president of Campus Crusade for Christ. In 1985, Bill Bright stood in front of his executive staff at Campus Crusade for Christ. And you know what he said? He said, I want to make sure that by the year 2000, this is in 1985, that 4.1 billion people have the opportunity of seeing the Jesus film. Well, you know, there was silence in the room. You know, a little shuffling of paper, but kind of silence. Everybody was kind of stunned by what it is that Bill had just stood up and said. And finally, you know, some people needed some clarification, so some hands rather timidly, you know, were raised and said, well, Bill, can you give me some clarification on that last number word? What was that word again? And he says, you mean billion? And they says, yeah, that was the word. And they kind of write it down. And somebody else says, well, Bill, that is everybody on planet Earth. And it was in 1985. And you know what Bill says? I know. And somebody else says, well, Bill, do you have any idea how much that would cost? And Bill says, I haven't the foggiest idea. And somebody else says, well, do you care? And he says, no. That launched what was for Campus Crusade the largest single funding initiative ever launched by Campus Crusade for Christ. They have raised millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars to translate the Jesus film, the story of the life of Christ from the Gospel of Luke, into the languages of the people of the earth. And you know something? Rarely did they talk about the funding need. They always talked about the vision. Imagine, you know, everyone in their own language around the world having the opportunity of hearing the claims of Jesus Christ upon their life. That story, that wonderful, precious, glorious story of the Gospel as it's recorded in the Gospel of Luke, and imagine everybody having the opportunity. I was in Prague just a few months ago, and there was billboards all over the city of Prague. Maybe you are from there or around there, and you were driving down the same highways that I was driving down, and they were announcing the Jesus film was being shown in theaters all throughout Prague. It was free admission. People were going, and people were coming to know Christ as their Savior. You know, Bill Bright went to be with the Lord just a year ago, and I was reading some of the obituaries, and the claims were in the obituaries that over 4 billion people had seen the Jesus film. The population of the earth has hence increased by a billion since 1985 or more. But the point is, when they talked, they led with their vision. They didn't talk about, well, we need $200 million or $500 million or $1 billion to do this. They didn't talk about that. They talked about the vision. It was the vision that really captured the imagination of people. So vision is pretty important. But there are two things missing. There are a lot of organizations that have great mission statements. Terrific mission statements. Nothing wrong with your mission statement, I doubt. You know, they have a pretty big vision. They perhaps haven't articulated it. I'd suggest that you start writing it out and talking to people about your vision. And when you present your ministry in behalf of others, don't talk about your need as much as you talk about your vision and about what it is that you've committed yourself to do and what it's going to look like when it's successfully accomplished. But they still fail. See, a lot of organizations have this and they have this, but they're still not successful because something's missing. And one thing that's missing is represented by this series of steps that go from the bottom of the triangle to the apex of the triangle, and I call that the strategic plan. And the strategic plan states, again, in quantifiable terms, the steps that must be taken this year, next year, the years thereafter, to bring us from where it is we are to where it is that we long to go. You need that strategic plan. And if it lacks quantification, if it lacks quantification, that plan is nothing more than a good idea. It'd be kind of a great idea, you know, if everybody on earth got to see the Jesus film. That'd be kind of a great idea. Kind of a nifty thought, isn't it? But if you don't have a plan to get it done, the realities are probably it's not going to happen. And a lot of you have great ideas for your ministry. You've got great, you know, thoughts and concepts that are kind of rolling around in the back of your mind. Said, boy, this would probably be great if this happened. Well, let me tell you, it probably is not going to, you know, apart from a plan. But interestingly enough, there are a lot of organizations that have great mission statements, great visions, and great strategic plans that still don't succeed because something else is missing. And it's represented by a series of steps on this side of the triangle. Again, that correspond with these steps. It doesn't exactly do it in my little drawing. And I call this the development or the business plan. And the development in the business plan, again, is quantifiable. It states in quantifiable terms the things that we must do in order to provide the resources that will be required in order to be able to accomplish these objectives. In other words, you know, there are resources that are going to be needed in order to be able to do the things that we've listed here. We're going to show the film and translate it into Mongolian, you know, in the year 2001, 2002. And it's going to cost us $85,000 to translate the Jesus film into Mongolian. Well, the realities are, if you don't have $85,000 to do that, it's probably not going to get done. And so you need a development plan that states, in essence, what it is that's going to be required. It's going to provide the $85,000 or the $185,000 or the $285,000 that's going to be required in order to be able to accomplish these objectives. It also provides the people that are going to be required as well as the time. So the three resources that need to be addressed within the context of the developmental business plan are time, people, and dollars. And we need to know what it is that we need in any given year in order to be able to accomplish that. But when these things work together, guess what happens? You know, vision is accomplished. And God can do things that are going to just blow us all away. And I want to be a part of that. And I know that you do too. The very idea of being a part of something that God's doing. I mean, I'm just awed to be here. I mean, there's a sense in which I come to Chopron and I'm meeting with Michael and some of these guys that are speaking here this week, and had dinner with them last night, and I'm just, some of these guys at the table at dinner time, they have forgotten more than I'll ever know. I mean, I'm just listening to some of those guys, and I'm just kind of in awe. I think, good night, what in the world am I doing here? But you know something? You know that God's given me something to say. Isn't it amazing to you, this whole concept of giftedness? I'm just kind of awed by, you know, spiritual giftedness. I'll give you my little thesis on this. This is probably not, you know, Chopron material, so you'll excuse me, but I'd like to tell you a little bit about giftedness from my perspective. Sue and I, we love to memorize scripture. It's kind of one of the things that we just enjoy doing together. And you know, when you travel 240 days a year, you're away from home, you got to try to figure out all these little things that you can do together to kind of keep you together spiritually and emotionally and all these other ways in which you want to stay in touch with your spouse. And one of the things that we've done over the years is we've just memorized scripture. And, you know, we've memorized books of the Bible and chapters and things. And one of the chapters that we memorized several years ago was Romans chapter 12. And it's a great chapter. And there's a verse in that chapter that says that we all have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us. Let each exercise them accordingly, if prophecy according to the, in your faith and so forth, and exhortation. And that just, you know, as we were memorizing that, it just caused me to kind of think a lot about giftedness. And I got thinking about it a lot. And I drew this conclusion, which I'm sure you would agree with, that God has gifted all of us in some very, very unique ways. And I think that's true. And then as I studied the scriptures a little bit more, it occurred to me that when God calls a work together, he provides all the giftedness that's required in order to be able to accomplish that work. I really believe that, and I think, you know, if you read 1 Corinthians, you know, you read the story of the Corinthian epistles, both 1 and 2 Corinthians, you see a kind of a dysfunctional church. And I think one of the reasons why it's dysfunctional is because, you know, people are working and not exercising their gifts. There are people that are exercising gifts that they shouldn't be and withholding the privilege or the opportunity from others and so forth. And, you know, when you read it in that kind of a context, it kind of just adds an interesting dimension to it. So I'm convinced that when God calls a work together, that all the giftedness that's required in order to be able to accomplish that work's been provided by God. I just really believe that. And then the third thing that I believe, and I think I can validate this, but that not all the gifts that are mentioned in the Scripture are all the gifts that God ever gave. You know, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? You know, you read 1 Corinthians chapter 12, and we read about all these gifts, and Paul says there are seemly gifts, and then he says there are unseemly gifts. And I, you know, in the context of the body, because he's talking about body parts and body functions in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, for the most part, he's, you know, in the context of the body, there are unseemly parts. You know, the pancreas, you know, bile ducts, you know, liver and spleen and intestines and all those kinds of things and cells. And, you know, the realities are I think they're probably pretty ugly to look at, and I'm not sure that I really want to know all that much about them, but I'm also pretty sure that I wouldn't want to function without one. I think probably, you know, a spleen's important and a liver's important and so forth. Well, and the doctor can help me, but you, I don't want to know, doc. So don't even go there. But so you know, with those kind of that basic thought, you know, I need to tell you something. For the first 40 years of my life, and I'm being very sincere now, for the first 40 years of my life, I wanted to be like somebody else. You know, I could go to a dinner meeting like I was at last evening, which was a wonderfully delightful and inspiring evening. And I could see all these people that I could just incredibly admire and say, well, boy, I'd sure like to be more like Peter. I'd like to be like Michael. You know, God's gifted them in such wonderful ways. And I could just kind of look at that and say, gee, I'd just like to be more like that. And I try to, you know, emulate in many ways some of their characteristics because I admired them so. I mean, it wasn't intending to copy, but I just, you know, they so ministered to me that I wanted to be like them that I try to do that. All along in my life, people would come up and say, you know, Jerry, you do this really, really well. I say, yeah. And they'd be talking about something that they saw me doing really, really well, and I'd just say, yeah. And I'd continue to emulate people that I admired, you know, wanting to be more like them. So, you know, time would go on. Somebody said, well, geez, Jerry, you know, you really do a good job at this. Yeah. Well, finally, I had a friend who was very, very courageous. And my friend said to me one day, we were riding down the road. I can remember where it was. We're riding down the road. There's a guy that I had known for, he's with the Lord now, but I'd known him for years and years and years. He was probably my best friend in the world. And we're riding down the road, and he says, you know, Jerry, he says, you do that really, really well. And he was referring to something, and I says, yeah. And he says, no, stop. And he made me stop the car. And he says, did you hear what I just said to you? I says, yeah, you said I did that really, really well. And he says, yeah. And you said, yeah. He says, anybody could do that. And he says, no, that's not right. Not everybody could do that. This is the reason, you know, that it's easy for you to do this. It's like water coming off a duck's back for you, but not everybody could do that. And he says, you know what I think you'd need to do? And I said, well, what? And he says, I think you need to accept that as God's gift to you. And then I think you need to ask yourself this question. How can I use that gift that God has given you to further the cause of the kingdom of God? It was a changing point in my life. It was a changing point in my life. You know, for 40 years, can you believe that I lived for 40 years as a Christian? Well, not 40 years as a Christian, but 25 of those 40 years as a Christian, you know, trying to be like somebody else. Until finally somebody said, you know, God's gifted you in an incredible way. You know, I'm sitting there at this meeting last night, and I'm thinking, you know, what in the world am I doing here? But, you know, there's something that, you know, I know something about, you know, that God has given me some understanding about. I can articulate it reasonably well, and it seems to motivate people and encourage people to do things. And, you know, it's just kind of this little tiny unseemly gift. But God uses it in our lives, and I hope He'll use it in the life of your organization in helping you to fulfill that great mission to which you've been called of God to do. And if God can use me in any one of your lives as a result of this, you know, these days, it would be a glorious joy for me to be able to be a part of that whole process. Okay? Are we doing okay? Any questions about that first part? And we can kind of begin. Yes?
Are you talking about creating a team or
Oh, over here? Well, I think, you know, obviously it's the people that would be required in order to be able to help you to accomplish that. It would be supporters, individuals, you know, that have come alongside in a variety of different ways. See, not, I think one of the problems that we have in development is that, you know, we value people only in terms, and many organizations value people only in terms of what it is that they can give to you in dollars. And if they can't give to you, we just kind of walk away from them. Say, well, gee, they can't help us, and so we're going to go away to the next person until we can find somebody that can help us. And I think that's devastating. You know, estimates out there, and I think this is particularly true in Eastern Europe, and we have many Eastern Europeans here. In 1989, the wall fell, and, you know, the underground church came to the surface and began to function more visibly, and a lot of organizations were established. You know, parachurch-type organizations, and many of you represent those kinds of organizations here today, and you're functioning in third-world countries. You've been a part of, you know, wherever that organization might be. Many of those organizations were established under Western influence, with a lot of Western support. Well, let me tell you, and I think I'm not telling you anything that you don't know, is that a lot of that support base is beginning to dry up. It's not quite as easily available to you today as it was, you know, 14 or 15 years ago, or 13 or 12 or even 10 years ago. And organizations kind of, you know, look to the West for their support without building relationships within their own country in many instances. Because, you know, if you can, you know, write to somebody in the West and they can send you $1,000, that's worth, you know, 100 people giving you, you know, a dollar or $10. And so we tend to look the wrong way. And in the process of that, not only were we hurting ourselves because we were impacting our ability to be able to be owned by the people that we are called of God to serve. You know, there's no sense of ownership. They kind of look at you and they say, well, that's just kind of a Western organization that's got, you know, that functions here within this country. And so consequently, there's no sense of ownership. In many instances, I'm not suggesting that would be true universally, but I think in many instances, that's true. And so estimates are out there that I have read recently that between 70 and 90% of parachurch organizations in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union are in danger of imminent closure because they failed over the last 15 years to build an infrastructure sufficient to be able to support what it is that God's called them to do. And that would be tragic. And so I've been to Kyiv and places around the world trying to you know, plead with them that we need to be thinking about these issues. See, a lot of people feel like development is kind of non-spiritual. You know, God brought us into existence. He can, you know, can keep us in existence. And if he doesn't keep us into existence, then that's okay. And, you know, I think that's, you know, I think that attitude is incredibly damaging. I mean, it put it in another context, and you would undoubtedly agree. I mean, if your attitude towards world evangelism is that, you know, that God could cause the rocks to cry out the message of salvation, so why should I bother? Well, I mean, God could call the rocks to cry out the message of salvation, but he didn't choose to do that, did he? He said, you know, you're to be witnesses to me in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and the uttermost parts of the earth. I mean, that's a mandate to us. And anybody that would say that to you, he'd say, that's irresponsible that you would say that. Because that's not what... And quite frankly, I think a lot of what it is that we've done in terms of ministries has been developmentally irresponsible. And now we're paying the price. And if things don't change, we're going to lose the opportunity, which I believe we're living in one of the greatest days of opportunity that God's ever granted a generation. You know, one of the things that we're going to be talking about here, which I'm pretty excited about, is we're doing an online forum. Every month, you can go to your computer, wherever you live, and all of you can do this. If you have access to a computer and if you have a dial-up connection that will take you to the internet, you could go, you could type in the letters dmagroup.org. You know, that's our ministry's website. You could press a button, you'd be there. You could press another button, and you would be transported immediately into a classroom.
along with 500 other Christian ministries around the world. We could all be there together in the same classroom. And I'm, you know, once a month I sit down in my office in Indianapolis, Indiana, and I talk to ministries all around the world. I do it three different days with three different groups. We have a North American, we have an online international forum that we're just beginning this year. We've already run a couple of practice runs with it to make sure it works all right. You know, we one day I get up and I press a button and there's some people from the Czech Republic there. There's some people from Ukraine there. They're all in the same classroom. We're talking back and forth, just like we were in the same room together. I mean, what an incredible day of unparalleled opportunity. You can be a part of that. We're going to be talking a lot about it in the context of the forum this week. You know, ways that we can be able to network together to do what it is collectively that we can't do by ourselves, at least as effectively and as efficiently as we can. But those are the kinds of things that we need to... We live in days of unparalleled opportunity. And you know, and there are many ministries that we're at risk at losing because we failed to build infrastructure, developmental infrastructure. And so I think that means I'm not suggesting that we don't accept money or seek to, you know, look to the West for support. But the realities are we can't, in the process, ignore what it is that's happening around us, because those people need to take ownership of what it is we're doing as well. Yes.
You talked about these four key elements. An organization is lacking one or more of things. What, in your experience, are the kind of the top reasons why people don't have vision or mission or strategic plan?
Well, the two areas that most people don't have are the two side ones, the strategic plan and the business plan. And the strategic plan, the reason why most organizations don't have a strategic plan is because many of them create strategic plans, you know, in a vacuum. And oftentimes that's a financial vacuum. In other words, you know, the strategic plan ends up being pie in the sky by and by. I mean, we're going to do this and that, and we're going to do that, and we're going to be the biggest, and we're going to be the best, and we're going to build all these huge buildings. And most people, when they see that plan, look at it and say, there's just no way that that's ever going to happen. They don't have the ability to be able to raise that money. And so the plan is irrelevant because it was created in a vacuum. And so plans need to be created within the context of the ability of the organization to be able to fulfill the plan. Because what happens? When people lose confidence, remember the reason that why people will fail to continue their support of you is because of a lack of confidence? When people lose confidence in your ability to do that, then they'll withhold your support. And so oftentimes that confidence is lost is when plans aren't completed. So organizations say, well, we're just not going to plan anymore because we did it once and it failed. Well, it's a catch-22, isn't it? Because the realities are you're kind of, you know, you're damaged if you plan and you're damaged if you don't plan. But so that's one of the reasons why strategic planning isn't done. And the development business plan is that nobody... And I'm not suggesting that I'm the only person that knows this, but I think, you know, how many donors do you need? You know, how big does your database need to be? And I'm not sure if I know that many people that have been able to answer that question. And so we kind of struggle on, we kind of do the things that we know we should be doing, and we're kind of hoping they're the right things, but we don't have any measurable pendulum to be able to assess whether or not that's really moving us forward in the kinds of ways and at the accelerated level that may be required in order for us to be able to achieve this vision to which we've committed ourselves. So I think mission and vision, you know, most organizations have mission, and if you push them hard enough, they can come up with a vision. You know, they can articulate a vision. But when it comes to strategic planning and development plan, they just haven't got the foggiest idea how to go about doing that process. I mean, there's not just the model, but creating, you know, a context, you know, that's essentially within reason for that particular organization at that particular time in its history and development.
Do you think it is that just developing a financial quantifier is just a very hard slot? I mean, it's not an easy thing to do, especially when you're starting from zero. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you've already got a quantified plan, you want to develop beyond it, so you're worried about your model. That's what's hard. When you come at it from the first time, it's just a very hard thing to do.
Oh, it's It is hard, and you know, part of that process, we're going to kind of work through that a little bit later, you know, in the subsequent session to this, and after our break. But there are groups. One of the first things that we would suggest that you do is is as you look at your vision, and you can even start thinking about this now, but as you're looking at your vision for what it is that you sense God's called you to do, then I think one of the first questions that you need to ask yourself is, you know, what kind of people, you know, what groups of people would resonate with that vision? I call those critical groups. In other words, there are groups of people. You know, the first step in the developmental process is what we call the identification of your prospects. Okay, in other words, you know, if you're going to, you know, thinking about getting married, you know, you're kind of prospecting, aren't you? I mean, I don't know about gals, and so please, I'm not. But, you know, when I was 8, I loved being 18 years old, 19 years old. I thought it was just a great time of the year until my sister intervened. She kind of just kind of threw everything off, you know. But I thought it was great, you know, because I was a chief of staff of a large camping operation. We'd hire, you know, about 500 staff members, and they'd all send their applications in. They'd all have pictures on them. Well, you know, as those, you know, those were coming across my desk because I'm kind of selecting, you know, staff members, I'd see a very attractive face, you know, and I think, well, this is somebody that I think would like to, you know. So I'm, you know, essentially what I was doing is I was kind of creating my date list for that year, you know, that summer. And but, you know, you identify your prospects. Well, then it becomes important after you identify people with whom you'd like to build a relationship is to qualify them. We're going to talk a little bit about that in just a few minutes. But one way to qualify them is to, first of all, put them into groups. You know, what groups do these individuals represent? So you may have professional people. You may have, you know, people, you know, evangelicals that are involved in local churches in the communities of which you're a part and so forth. And so from a developmental standpoint, it's a whole lot easier to strategize around what I call critical groups. And then we'll talk about how to, you know, build the toehold that you need in order to be able to expand your ministry in ways that are consistent with your need. We're ready?
Yes, they're ready for you. When you go out here, if you turn left, go through the double doors, they have coffee set up.
Great. Take the strong stuff, okay? Some of you have been traveling all day. You're on a different time zone. I don't. Have you recovered yet? Or what time is it in Sydney right now?
Yeah, middle of the
night. Pardon me?
Middle of the night.
Middle of the night? Yeah, it's, let's see, it's 7:56 a.m. at home, so Sue's just getting out of bed, so.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Your personal stories are quite inspiring.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm not sure that I addressed that specifically, but I'm certainly not, you know, opposed to kind of, you know, evaluating and thinking through that with you. You know, the challenge, you know, obviously is to, the thing that I've been concerned about, and I think, you know, manipulation is really kind of an important issue with me, because I think, you know, to the extent that we try to manipulate people at the extent of building relationships with them, then we aren't really acting, in, you know, consistently with the scriptures. And so I kind of measure everything in terms of that, in terms of what I perceive as being, you know, biblical versus non-biblical. You know, there are all kinds of examples, you know, from David and the preparations that he made, you know, to build the temple, and, you know, Moses and the things that they did, which, you know, interestingly enough, you know, a part of what was built or used to build the tabernacle were things that the Egyptians gave the Israelites as they're moving out of Egypt, you know, that God gave them favor in the minds of many of the Egyptians, who gave them gifts as they were leaving, and many of those gifts were given back to the Lord. And so there's interest in precedent in the scriptures, which may not necessarily be as applicable in our situation as it was in theirs. So I think they're precedent that we can look at, but I'm not sure it's as clear to say that this is, you know, motive determines a lot of what might be perceived as being non-biblical or sinful versus, you know, actual practice. So we can talk about that, though. Helpful so far today? I mean, you've caught an idea or two. And, you know, we're probably, you know, the question is raised, you know, how much are we going to be able to get done today? And I suspect that we're probably not going to get through the notes, you know, to the extent that they're written there for you. Part of that, and I this is a confession, okay, so I'll confess to you. you know, I did the same seminar last year, And what happened last year was, I covered so much in this session, and then a lot of people came to workshops, and there was a lot of repetition because I was essentially, because there was a new group coming in that hadn't heard what it is that the ones that came to the preform heard, and so there was an essential, I mean, you were part of that group, I think, where I was repeating myself a lot. And I'm trying to avoid that today as much as I can. I think there probably will be some repetition. Not everybody's going to come to the network that's going to come to the workshops and so forth. And I'm not trying to, keep you from doing workshops. We are going to cover two important concepts here in this latter part of the day that I think you'll find to be very, very helpful and very, very practical because, the realities are, we've got to move beyond the realm of conceptual development to something that's, we can get our arms around and we can say, okay, well, I can do this. These are steps that I can realistically take. And to the extent that you do that, you'll experience success as you've not known it already or perhaps ever before. The next little module, if you turn to the module two, the statement is, marry you, I don't even know you. The illustration that I was seeking to draw there is one that I've told frequently as it relates to Sue. You're going to hear a lot about Sue because she becomes a little bit of the focus of some of my illustrations. But there came a point in time, I told you how I met Sue, and my sister, set me up and realizing that Sue was probably a good match for me. And Sue and I, dated, and we spent a lot of time together. We went on picnics. We went to ball games. We went to long hikes. We had lots of meals where we just discussed and talked about everything that we could possibly think of. And there came a point in time when I took Sue to Maine. My parents, my father has been a caretaker of a farm on the coast of Maine. It's a 100-acre farm. It's right on the coast. It's right on the water. It's quite an incredible place, and we've spent a lot of our growing up time, there on the farm, or coming back from college and schools and so forth. We come back to the farm, and there's off to the edge of one of the pastures. You're right on the rocky coast of Maine, and there's a big, huge rock there, and it's a rock, that many times as I was growing up. In my young adult life, I would go out to that rock and many times just go out and kind of gaze out to the ocean, and pray and think, meditate, and just kind of reflect on God. And time went on, I'd go out there in the summertime, and I'd sit down at the rock and have my devotions, and sometimes I'd just go out with a good book. But all the time I was doing that, when I was single, I was noticing that the rock had an interesting shelf on it. In other words, you could sit here, and there was another rock down below, and I had always envisioned taking the girl that I was going to ask to marry me out to the rock, and I was going to sit her at this one particular point, and I was going to get down on my knees on that little shelf, and I was going to ask her to marry me. And so I did that. I had this little place, and I was going to take Sue down to it, and I took her down to the rock. Now, the one thing that I had quite the one wrong part of my plan was I decided to do that in February. It gets real cold in Maine in February, on the rock. But I took her down to the rock, and I got down on my knees, and I read her a poem that I'd written to her. And at the end of the poem, it says, "Will you?" And she said, "Yes." And so I, took the ring out of my pocket, and I put it on her finger, and I said, "Let's go in where it's warm," And we walked into the farmhouse and told my folks. Well, the realities, and the point that I want to make with the story is the realities are I knew she was going to say yes. I mean, there was no mystery whatsoever, that she was going to say yes. We talked about getting married. We talked about spending our lives together. We talked about the things that we could do collectively or together that we couldn't do singularly and really impacting our world in the ways that we sense God was calling us to do that. And so she was kind of wondering whenever I was going to get around to asking. I mean, the question is not that she was going to say yes. The question is, when's he going to ask me type of a situation. But I could create a number of different scenarios where it might not be as likely that she would say yes. For example, let's assume that I've dated her for we've had three or four dates and we've had some nice conversations and so forth. So I take her down to the rock because I happen to be in Maine and she happens to be there. So I take her down to the rock because I want to save a little bit of money, and I take her down. I sit her down. I get down on my knees and do the same thing. Well, she might say no after three dates, because there's a lot of things that undoubtedly we haven't discussed, things that, you know, would be pertinent for her to know before she could, with confidence, commit herself and the rest of her life to spending, you know, with this guy. So she might say yes and she might say no. Now assume that I take her down after the only one date. But it was a good time. You know, we had went to a movie or something, and we had a great time together, and went out to dinner, and we talked a lot, and we had a lot in common. So I decide, you know, since it's convenient, I take her down to the rock, and I get down on my knees, and I ask her. And, you know, after one date, it's pretty unlikely that she's going to say yes. Now, I'll even be a little bit more ridiculous. Let's say that we're in the grocery store, and I'm buying some groceries as a single guy, and I happen to be kind of walking down the aisle, and I see this other, you know, this beautiful gal, Sue. You know, she's walking down the other side, and I notice that, you know, as I look at her hands on the cart, she doesn't have a ring on, and so I'm assuming that she's single. And so I take a look at her, and I think about it, and she's kind of cute, you know, and I turn around, and I come down the other side of the aisle, and she's coming up the other side, and I'm thinking, well, why not? You know, I mean, hey, let's just give it a chance. So I tap her on the shoulder and says, well, honey, would you like to marry me? And she hits me over the head with, you know, the milk carton, you know, marry you, I don't even know you. Well, obviously, and I've taken two ridiculous scenarios or four ridiculous scenarios or three ridiculous scenarios and one that's pretty realistic. Let's say for the sake of illustration that in the first example that I gave you, the actual proposal that I made to Sue, that in that particular case, she was an A prospect, okay? She was well-cultivated. I mean, we had courted, we had visited, we talked about the things that were important to both of us, and so she was ready. I knew she was going to say yes. Let's say in the second scenario, the one after four or five dates, that she's a B prospect. You know, she's kind of cultivated. We've spent a lot of time. We've continued to date and, you know, talk and visit and so forth. In the third case, she's a C prospect. Kind of cultivated, but not really, you know. And in the last one, she's a D prospect, okay? So let me create a little bit of a scenario for you. Here's a person with whom you'd like to build a relationship. You know, someone that you feel would have a, you know, a real interest in the support of your organization, the ministry that you represent. Now, there are two things that you should know about that individual that are very, very important for you to know. One has to do with what I call cultivation. How well cultivated are they? And there's some possibilities here. They could be very well cultivated. Let's call those A's. They could be kind of cultivated. Let's call those B's. They could be sort of cultivated. Let's call those C's. And they could be not cultivated at all. Let's call those D's. Okay? So that's pretty important for you to know. The other thing that's important for you to know is what I call vestiture. And what I mean by vestiture is that you have prospects, some of whom will be vested in your ministry. In other words, they've invested something, they've been volunteers, they've been to activities that your ministry has sponsored, they have supported you financially, they're vested. You know, maybe their son or their daughter, you know, or some family member has benefited from the services that you provide, and so there's a sense of vestiture there. They have benefited in some meaningful way by the services that you provide. But then you have what I call a non-vested prospect. In other words, that's somebody who, you know, basically, you know, is a legitimate prospect, someone who maybe loves the Lord and really could theoretically believe in what it is that you're doing and might have the ability and the interest in supporting you, but they've never had any involvement strategically whatsoever in what it is that you're doing. So we're going to call them non-vested. It's the combination of these two that are going to determine your effectiveness. In other words, if you're going to go into an annual fund effort, let's say to, you know, ask people to support you financially this year to help you fulfill the mission objectives to which you've committed yourself, one of the first things that I'd suggest that you do is to come up with a list of prospects. I mean, who are you going to ask to support you? Who are the people that you're going to go to and ask to invest in your ministry this year by considering a contribution to support your organization. And so you're going to come up with a list. And let's say you come up with 150 names. And so we begin to look at that list. I said, okay, let's kind of go through the list and let's first of all sort it on the basis of vestiture. So you pass the list around to people that might know names that have been listed on the sheet of paper that you've drawn up. And people go through and they say, well, this person's vested and this person's vested, but this person's not vested to my knowledge, and I know them pretty well, but they're not vested in our ministry and so forth. And then just arbitrarily, let's give them an A, B, C, D ranking. In other words, yeah, we think they're kind of cultivated, but I'm not sure that they're as well cultivated. And you know, intuitively, we probably can do that pretty accurately. Well, if you had 150 names and 130 of those 150 names were non-vested D's, you know, how successful do you think that campaign initiative is going to be? You know, probably not all that successful at all, right? You know, it's kind of interesting. I'm one of these people, and I suspect that I'm not unusual in this regard. I find it really hard when people don't like me. You know, it just is. That just really bothers me. I mean, I want everybody to like me. I don't want necessarily, and I understand that not everybody will agree with me, but I'd like them to like me. I mean, if you were to leave here today and go down to see Greg Pritchard and say, well, that guy's an idiot. I don't know why you ever invited him to come to this conference, but that man is totally a jerk. I mean, I would feel horrible. I mean, I would just feel terrible. And you know, I'd probably find out, well, Greg, who told you that? And, well, it was Mark or Steve. And I said, oh, my word. I said, I am so sorry. And I'd run and I'd find out where Steve was staying, and I'd knock at his door, and I'd say, well, Steve, if I said anything at all that was offensive or anything, please forgive me, because I want everybody to like me. And I think we're probably all the same way at one level or another. Some people, you know, act like they don't care, but the reality is I think probably all of us, you know, in our heart of hearts feel, you know, the need to be accepted and responded to in an affirmative way. Well, you know, here I've been in a business for 35 years where I've talked to tens of thousands of people about investing in ministry. And here's a guy that can't handle rejection. I mean, how in the world has, you know, how have I survived, you know, all these years? Well, a lot of the things that I've just told you, I kind of knew intuitively. I mean, I would never go to a non-vested D prospect and ask them to invest in my ministry because I knew they would say no. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times that my employers over the years have said, here are 12 names of 12 multi-millionaires in and with their pocket change. They could support our ministry and never, ever miss it for the next 100 years. Go ask them for money. Now, some of you have been asked to do that, haven't you? I mean, if you haven't been asked to do that, that would be surprising, especially if you've been in the development profession for any length of time. Somebody will say, well, you know, go and talk to Bill Gates. You know, Bill Gates is the richest man in the world. Go ask him for $1 million or $2 million. He could afford it. He would never miss it. You know, like I'm going to go and talk to Bill Gates about giving $2 million. I mean, I know intuitively at the very beginning that if I were to go to him and if I were by some realm of possibility get an appointment to talk to him, that he's probably going to say no to me, because he's non-vested and he's D in terms of relationship. Now, a number of years ago, we came up with an acronym in our company, and that acronym is the word AID, A-I-D. Now, in an acronym, every letter represents another word, and so let me suggest to you that the letter A represents the word attendance. Okay, so write that one down, attendance. You know, people can come to something that your organization sponsors. Or there are two ways of accomplishing attendance. I mean, you could go to them, right? I mean, you could go to a church, you could go to a small group, you could go to dinner with someone and essentially, you know, provide them the exposure to who it is you are and what it is that you're doing. So attendance is accomplishable in a variety of ways. So A stands for attendance. I stands for involvement. There are things that people could do to become involved in your organization. And I think, you know, you need to think in terms of things that people can do to become involved in your organization short of giving a gift. You know, I think, you know, so often we think, well, you know, a person's value is only in terms of what it is they can give to you. And if they can't give you a gift, then we're going to kind of leave them, or we're going to go on to someone else. And boy, does that person feel manipulated. because you have just shown them that their importance to you is predicated on what it is that they can give to you financially, and you care less about anything else that they could provide. Well, the realities are people can provide a lot of things. We have many organizations that provide a variety of opportunities, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that in just a few seconds. And then thirdly, D stands for donation. Let's just suggest that a person could make a donation to support your organization. They could do that. And now, what we have concluded over the years, this is kind of an easy way of kind of looking at a database list that you might have. If somebody has done all three of these, they would equal an A. If they've done two of the three, they would equal a B. If they've done one of the three, they would equal a C. And if they've done none of the three, they would equal a D. Now that's something that all of you could do, because you could actually go through your database, and with the help of perhaps some of your supporters and others, you know, on your staff, you could probably go through and do a little bit of an arbitrary assessment of your database. You see, there's an assumption that we make in ministry, and I don't think it's necessarily related to development. It's an assumption that we make in a variety of ways in the context of ministry. That is a wrong assumption, and that is that everybody in the database, you know, our database, is in the same relationship to the organization as the person next to them in line. In other words, you know, next to Twombly is Thomas, and we're assuming that both Mr. Thomas and Mr. Twombly are in the same relationship to our organization as everybody else in the database, and we know that that's not true. You know, pastors make that assumption, don't they, oftentimes, that the same person, you know, that people sitting in the same pew at church, that the person sitting next to the next person to the next person, that they're all in the same relationship with the Lord as the person sitting next to them, and we know that that's not true. That we're all on this journey together. We're all carrying, you know, certain pieces of baggage, you know, as we seek to honor God in our lives and in our work and so forth, and we have special needs that the Spirit of God needs to touch. And to the extent that that's recognized and addressed, then we have an impacting ministry. But to the extent that we don't recognize that, then a lot of what it is that we have to say just kind of goes over everybody's head. Now, what we've discovered, interestingly enough, and I think if you want to just kind of look at predictability patterns, let me share with you something that I think is probably going to be interesting to you. I think there's about a 0% likelihood that a D prospect, when invited and extended the invitation to come alongside and to be a part of what it is that you're doing, there's about a 0% likelihood that they're going to say yes. There's about a 30% likelihood that a C prospect, you know, given that same opportunity, would say yes, a 60% likelihood that a B prospect would say yes, and about a 90% likelihood that an A prospect would say yes. Well, but you know what I figured out just kind of intuitively, you know, early in my career, that I was going to spend most of my time talking to people about investing in my ministry that were B's and A's. And I was going to spend a lot of time here, you know, essentially seeking to move these D's to C's and these C's to B's, and by doing so increase the likelihood of their ongoing participation in what it is that we were doing. And that's been kind of the key to survival for me, this guy that can't handle rejection really well. You know, the realities are I can probably count on one hand the number of people when given the opportunity to become a part of what it is that I was involved in, I can probably count on one hand the number of people that have said no over the last 35 years. Now, part of that is because I'm old and I don't remember anymore. Or it's kind of selective memory or whatever the case might be. But a part of it is true, that the realities are that not that many people have ever said no. Now, there's a couple of reasons why that's the case, and then we'll explain that in just a little bit. But the realities are that's very, very important for you to understand. I mean, some of you have heard that if you send out a direct mail piece, you know, on behalf of your organization, and a lot of you are using direct mail to solicit funds, you know, for people to come alongside and support you in a variety of ways. It's been said that if you get a 2% response, that's kind of the national average, or probably the international average in this particular environment. I mean, if you send out a letter and you get a 4 or 6% response, you're feeling pretty good, aren't you? You're thinking, well, gee, that's pretty cool. I mean, if the 2% is the international average on direct response marketing and we've gotten 4 to 6%, we've kind of beaten the odds. If you get a 10% response, you're almost euphoric. But the realities are you? Is there a basis for that? Do you really feel good about that? I mean, if you get a 10% response to a direct response marketing piece, guess what? 90% of the people chose not to respond to you. And that doesn't really, you know, resonate really well with my heart, and I suspect not yours as well. But the reason I suspect that, you know, you get a 4% or a 6% or a 10% response is that about 10% of your database, you know, was A and B, and the majority of your database, 90%, were probably C and D. And you weren't doing anything proactively to address that. So the key to an organization like Habitat for Humanity, who has, you know, essentially, you know, 2 million people on their database, the key is first of all understanding, you know, where those people are. The second thing that I think is important to understand is that within that 2 million people, there are what I call critical groups. Okay, now I define a critical group as any group of people you perceive as being critical to your success. Okay? In other words, you may look at your constituency, let's say working with a student ministry that you are in the UK. You know, one of the groups that you would probably perceive as being critical to your success would be, you know, alumni. You know, people who have been through the program, who've graduated from university, now they're out serving the Lord and having a real impact. And you say, well, that's a critical group. That's a group of people with whom we'd like to, you know, really cultivate relationships with, because they certainly, you know who it is we are and what it is that we've committed them, you know, ourselves to do, and they've benefited. They're vested. They've benefited in what it is that we provide. So that would be a critical group. But you might say, well, the parents of those alumni would be a critical group too, because if they're Christians and they love the Lord, they feel incredibly indebted to your ministry, because, you know, their child went off to university and there you were there for them, and you came alongside and you helped preserve my child. And those of you that have children that have gone through university and they've made it and they still love the Lord, you really do feel a sense of gratitude for what it is that, you know, that organization has done. And you know, our son was at the University of Colorado and got involved with the university chapter at the University of Colorado. We still support those people that were a part of that, you know, the university chapter, because we're so grateful to them, you know, that they were there and they took our son under their wing, and the husband and wife kind of nurtured him and discipled him, and we've become, you know, lifelong friends. He's been out of college now for almost 10 or 15 years, and yet we still feel an incredible devotion to InterVarsity for the role that they played in terms of our son's life. So that would be a critical group. So there are all kinds of critical groups. Now, we're going to leave this for a second, but we're going to come back, okay? So don't be alarmed, but I want you to understand that of all the groups that you would ever identify as groups representing potential supporters to your ministry, okay, of all the groups that you would ever identify, they're going to fall into three broad categories. The first of those categories is what I call a nuclear prospect, or a nuclear group. And what I mean by nuclear is, here are groups of people that you've identified as being critical to your ability to be able to succeed and fulfill the mission to which you've been called of God. Here's a group of people that benefit or have in the past benefited directly from the services that you provide. Okay, so that would be an important group to know about. You know, those groups that would fall into those categories. You know, somebody that came to know Christ through a crusade, you know, that Michael has been, you know, preaching. And here's somebody that, you know, came to know Christ, his life has been transformed. You know, he's a very prominent business person in his in the area where so you've identified this group of people, you know, Christian business people. And here's a guy, you know, that's a nuclear prospect. You know, business people who've responded in faith to the provisions of Christ, you know, at a crusade. I mean, you could be that specific as it relates to the group. Okay, so nuclear prospects. Then you have another series of groups that would fall into another category, and I call those affinity prospects. And those are groups who benefit indirectly from the services you provide. Okay, so there are a number of other groups that, that kind of benefit just by your existence. I suspect in campus life there are groups of people that if you were to analyze it, and I'm not sure that I could do it, you know, standing up here on the spot, but I suspect there are any number of groups that benefit indirectly from the services you provide, like local churches within the area around where the campus is located, because you bring these students in and they participate in a local church and they become active in that local church, and so your existence benefits people within that congregation, perhaps. So there are what I call affinity prospects, and then there are what I call fringe prospects. And a fringe prospect is someone who may have a geographic or an emotional connection to your organization, but they may not know that much about you particularly. In other words, geographically, they live in the same town where you provide your services. They're Christians. They love the Lord. You know, it could be businesses, it could be corporations, it could be, wealthy people, you know, who love the Lord. It could be foundations or trusts, you know, that grant money to organizations like yours, you know, who function in the same area where you provide services and so forth. But they're a fringe prospect, okay? So now you have what I call nuclear prospects, affinity prospects, and fringe prospects. Now, there are a series of rules that kind of drive the developmental process. I want to introduce to you one of those rules, okay? There are all kinds of rules that are relevant to this particular ministry that I've committed my life to. But here's one rule, and it's a very important rule. It's called the rule of linkage. Now, let me explain the rule of linkage to you. The rule of linkage, simply stated, is this. The closer someone is linked to you, the greater the likelihood that they'll support you. Now, that's not rocket science, but the realities are, it makes sense, doesn't it? If you were to look at these three broad categories, nuclear, affinity, and fringe, which the groups that would fall into which category would you feel would be the most likely to support you? That's a question. Nuclear. Why? Because they're the closest link to you, aren't they? I mean, they have benefited from the services that you provide, and so there's a greater likelihood that a nuclear prospect is going to support you than a fringe prospect. Now, there are two subpoints under the rule of linkage, okay? There are two subpoints that are important to remember. Number one, there's what is I call natural linkage. My sisters and I are naturally linked together. We're both from the same birth parents, and all three of us. And, you know, I was born on Christmas Day. I don't know if any of you are born on Christmas Day. It's a hard day to be born, let me tell you, because it really shows the colors of your frugal relatives and friends, you know, who are quick to hand you a package and say, Happy Birthday, Merry Christmas. And I try to remind them that those are two events, but they just don't get it, you know. I says, there's two events and there's only one package here. I'll be 60 this year, and my sisters are older than I am, so you can imagine. They still believe in, you know, Santa Claus because they feel like that's the only rational explanation for their brother, you know, that somebody had to come from the North Pole, land a sled on the roof, you know, and kind of drop this little bundle of joy down the fireplace chimney. And there on Christmas morning, you know, 1944, our brother shows up, you know. But I can point to my parents like they can and say, well, I'm the product of that relationship. See, we're naturally linked. Now, if my parents had chosen to adopt a child into our family as we were growing up, then they would be a member of our family as well, wouldn't they? And so through the adoptive process, what did we do? We created linkage. So there's two kinds of linkage. There's natural linkage and there's created linkage. All right? And that's very, very important that you understand that from a developmental standpoint, because what I'm going to tell you next is one of the high priorities of things that you need to think through from a developmental standpoint as you're implementing development within your organization. Because the greatest challenge that faces us in many respects in development is the response to this question. How can I create linkage with someone or with groups with whom I do not have it naturally? Okay? So remember, the groups and only the groups that are in the nuclear category are the only groups that with whom you have natural linkage. From this point on, then you need to respond to the question, how can I create linkage? What can I do to create linkage with groups of people that, with whom we don't have it naturally? Now, let me give you some examples of creating linkage. And there are so many examples that are appropriate here, and I think most of you could think of any number of others that, that would be unique to your organization. Compassion International. And World Vision and a lot of those other organizations, and it doesn't need to be limited to organizations like that, but in our country, there's a strong movement, pro-life movement, that is represented in crisis pregnancy centers that are located, you know, throughout the country. And a lot of Christian schools are using sponsorship as a way of creating linkage. In other words, in the crisis pregnancy center movement in the U.S., it's impossible. You can't, you know, for confidentiality purposes and legal purposes, you can't identify the name of a client. But what they'll ask an individual to do is they'd ask them to sponsor a client that will come in. And what essentially they do is they're asked to write a letter to a young lady who's considering an abortion. And it's an anonymous letter. You know, it's just a letter, you know, that, dear friend, you know, I realize that you face, you know, an important decision in life. And I just want you to know, and it's written anonymously, and they're sent to the agency. And when that gal has been talked to and has been, you know, invited to consider, you know, an alternative to abortion, you know, i.e. keeping the baby, they've been challenged to consider that, you know. And they may go out of the room. The counselor may go out of the room and says, "Well, here's a letter that's been written by one of our friends of our ministry, and perhaps you'd like to read that." And it's been known that those letters have made the difference. You know, just getting that letter and reading the letter. Now, the person identifies themselves in the letter. You know, my name is so and so, and if the girl chooses to follow up with a letter, oftentimes that happens, and so there's relationships that are established there. And all of a sudden, you know, there are people that are interacting with one another that haven't interacted before. And through that sponsorship program, you know, relationships are built. And so that provides a link. Sue and I support, I think, 6 or 7. I'm not sure what the number is now because it kind of goes up every year. Students or children, you know, that are helped by Compassion International. It's a ministry out of Colorado Springs. And so we started doing that a number of years ago, and we've had people that have graduated from the program. But that sponsorship program creates linkage, okay? So now we have linkage to the organization through a program that was introduced by that organization to enable us to participate in some tangible way in what it is that is happening in conjunction with their work. Here's another way of creating linkage. A lot of organizations have prayer partner networks. In other words, and a lot of these organizations will just go to congregations, and I would encourage you to do that. I mean, if you're not doing it, it's something that I would really encourage you to think through. As you're talking to people in the variety of settings in which God provides you that opportunity, say, hey, listen, you know, we're asking the Lord for 1,000 or 2,000 or maybe 10,000 people who just to choose to pray for us on a regular basis. And if you'd like to be one of our prayer partners, we'd love to, you know, send you a prayer guide, a 30-day prayer guide that would help you to pray intelligently for our ministry. Now, if you're really good from a developmental standpoint, you may want to create 30 prayer requests that emerge right out of your mission statement. In other words, look at your mission statement, you know, because remember, your mission statement is the essence of rationality. Look at your mission statement and say, okay, you know, here's some things we'd like you to pray for. So, you know, think of a client now or an individual who's actually praying through your mission statement every year, I mean, every month. And the thing, I mean, now, you know, our rational understanding of who it is you are and what it is you're all about is really beginning to take root in their hearts. You know, maybe you take that 30-day prayer guide and you put it on a magnet that, you know, somebody could put on their refrigerator door. And so, you know, as they go to the calendar or they go to the door to get their, you know, milk for their Wheaties, they're saying, okay, it's June the 5th, it's the 5th of the month. Well, here's the prayer request. And so just as you go and you thank the Lord for your breakfast that morning, you just, you know, pray for the ministry of the organization and what it is that it's doing to impact the lives of people. And so through the Prayer Partners program, what have you done? You've created linkage with someone with whom you didn't have it naturally. There are many ministries that I know of that have like corporate partnership programs. you know, where corporations and business owners, you know, are appealed to on behalf of an organization to become members of the corporate partnership program. And in some instances, you know, that may mean, you know, an annual contribution of $50 a year or $100 a year. Some organizations, if they're asking for money, would suggest that they consider a contribution of $1 or $2 or $5 for every full-time employee that their organization or their company represents. And they do things with their corporate partners beyond, you know, just accept their money. They actually have programs where they minister to them in special ways, and they recognize them as important partners in enabling them to accomplish what it is they've committed themselves to do. But what have they done through the corporate partnership program? They've created linkage with someone with whom they don't have it naturally. Some organizations with whom we work have seniors auxiliaries. You know, a lot of senior citizens just, you know, don't have the opportunity of, you know, doing a lot of things, but there's a lot of things because they have available time at their hands that they could do in terms of helping the organization as hosts and hostesses for special events or participating in unique ways that would be compatible with what it is that they could bring to the table in terms of talent and giftedness and so forth. But the point is that in each of those instances, what have we done? We've created linkage. And, oh, by the way, we've improved likelihood. Let's say that at the end of the year, we're going to be mailing out 10,000 letters to the people on our database who, and ask them to consider a Christmas gift to our ministry. So we send them out a letter. And of those 10,000 letters, 5,000 are going to people that we've just accumulated the names in a variety of different ways, you know, that they're on our database. We don't know how they got there, but they're there. And 5,000 of the 10,000 are prayer partners, people who have chosen to become a prayer partner in support of our ministry. You know, which group of those two groups would you expect to be more likely to respond to an appeal to help you financially at year end? And I think most of you would say, well, the prayer partners. Why? Because there's linkage there. You've created linkage. So one of the most important questions that you need to answer, and I'm going to give you three questions today before you leave, what I call the three most important questions of development. If you can answer these three questions, you're going to see some dramatic things happen in the context of your ministry. But the first question that you must answer is, how can I create linkage with groups of people that I have identified that are critical to my future with whom I don't have it naturally? Are there ways, meaningful ways, that I can create linkage? Now, going back to our drawing here, let me share with you any number of things. I mean, obviously, if somebody, you know, comes to an event, and I think we need to be, you know, a little bit more creative in ways to engage people to attend things. I mean, people can come to events. I was always frustrated with this couple, you know, that was the university people in the University of Colorado where my son was. And because every year they'd come to us, they'd ask us out to dinner or lunch, they'd come to our house and they'd thank us for supporting them. And, you know, we didn't need that. I mean, it was nice that they did that, but, you know, but they said, is there something else that you could do? And I said, or we can do to enhance our relationship with you. And I said, you know, we just like to come to an event sometime. They had a retreat center somewhere off in the mountains, and you know, periodically they would take students from the university and they'd go up there to the retreat center. And, you know, if there was ever a possibility, we would just love to go up there and just kind of see what it is that you're doing with students. I think that would be a real encouragement to us. Well, eventually, you know, efforts were made to get us to come to one of those activities, but that attendance is important. Because it's one thing, I mean, I appreciate what it is that they've done in the life of my son, but I really, you know, wasn't sure what it is that they were doing on a broader scale to minister to students in the ways that were unique to that organization. So I think we need to think through attendance opportunities. What kind of opportunities can we provide to expose people to what it is that we're doing? I mean, it may be special receptions, it may be dinners, it could be any number of things. But recognizing that if somebody comes to one of those events who's never been to an event like that in the past, exponentially, what happened? The likelihood of their participation in an ongoing way in the support of what it is that we're doing in the variety of ways in which people could become engaged exponentially increased from 0 to 30% just through one activity. In the same way with involvement. How could people become involved? I mean, I think that's a question that you really need to ask. How could people become involved? They could be involved through prayer. They could be involved as volunteers. They could be involved in a variety of ways, which you'll see when we get to the organizational model, which we're not going to get to today. But you'll see there's all kinds of ways in which people can become engaged in the support of your organization. But let me give you what I think is one of the best ideas I've had in 30 years. You know, my wife says I have an idea every minute, you know, or 20 seconds. So she says, well, I got an idea. She says, oh, yeah, here he goes again. You know, but I did come up with something a number of years ago that I think is one of the best developmental ideas I've had in 30 years. And I'm not being facetious. I think this is something that you all can do and that you should do. And so let me share with you my idea. And I call it the two-hour task force meeting. Now, you don't have to call it that, but that's kind of a working definition of this idea. It's called a two-hour task force meeting. But let me explain, you know, pretty much how it works. We were working with a client that was getting ready to go into a major funding campaign. We did with that client what we do with all of our clients that are, you know, contemplating going into a major project of the nature of which they were preparing for. And that is, we ask them this question. You know, practically speaking, as you're looking at the project and you're looking at the potential out there, what groups of people would you perceive as being critical to your success? And so they came up with a whole lot of groups. You know, people that they recognized as being critical to their success. The organization with whom we were working happened to be a parochial school. Okay, so it was associated with a particular denomination. And one of the groups that they identified were businessmen that were a part of that denomination. You know, people who understood parochial education. In many instances, they were the product of parochial education themselves. And they recognized that if they were to be involved in the support of our organization, there's a greater likelihood that we're going to achieve success if they weren't involved. Well, the next question I asked them was this. Who are the critical members of the critical group? Now, that's an important question because every group has critical members. If I were to give you the membership directory of the church where you worship, if you have a directory like that, and most churches do, if I were to hand you that directory and give you a highlight pen, say, okay, well, just tell me, who are the critical members of the critical group? I mean, who are the people that are the movers and the shakers, the influencers, the people that kind of shape the opinions of others within your congregation? If I were to give you a highlight pen in 20 minutes, I suspect most of you could do that pretty quickly, couldn't you? I mean, you know who they are. I mean, it's going to be so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. Well, they did that with this group of businessmen who were part of the denomination. Well, what I suggested that they do, after some rumination and thinking and so forth, which I'll not get into, what I asked them to do, I said, well, why don't we just ask them if we can, you know, if some of the, you know, those critical members of the critical group would be willing to come to a breakfast meeting at, say, 6 o'clock in the morning at a local restaurant. And remind them that when we invite them to that breakfast meeting, that our intention is not to ask them for money. Okay? So you're getting the point. We'd love to have you come for breakfast. It's going to be a two-hour meeting. You know, we're not going to ask you for any money, so you can feel comfortable. But there are a number of things that we'd kind of like to, you know, share with you and to seek your input on. And that's exactly the way we approach them. All right? So you're catching the drift here of how this is coming together. Well, let's assume that we get 3 or 4 of those people together, or 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 of them together. And let's say that I'll do a little role-playing now, okay? I'll be the executive director of your ministry. And you're just finishing breakfast, okay? The waitress is coming, and she's beginning to gather the plates. And so I stand up, okay? So you're sitting in the restaurant, I'm standing up, and I'm Tim McMahon. You know, thanks so much for coming. Perhaps, you know, you're wondering a little bit, you know, how you get invited to this meeting. So let me just share with you a little bit behind what it is that was a part of the invitation that was extended to you. I was at a meeting not too long ago, and And I listened to this guy, and he was talking about, you know, organizational development and so forth. And one of the questions that he posed to us was, you know, who are the groups of people that you perceive or I perceive as being critical to the success of our ministry? If we were to look, you know, just arbitrarily at all the groups of people that are out there that might have an interest in becoming involved in what it is we're doing, you know, who are the groups of people that you would perceive as being critical? And so I was just sitting there in the meeting, and I was just kind of, you know, making a list of groups of people that I felt would be critical to our success. And the group that you represent was one of the groups that I had mentioned. Well, then the next question he posed to us was this, that who are the critical members of the critical group? So I started walking around to some of my board members and some of the friends of our organization. I shared with them these groups, and I said, do you know people within those groups that are kind of movers and shakers within that group? And somewhere in the context of all of that, your name was mentioned. So the reason that you're invited to this meeting is because you are perceived as being a critical member of a critical group of people that we recognize as important to our ability to be able to fulfill, you know, the calling of God as terms of our ministry. Now, I provided you a handout, and I'd like you to just take a look at that. That's a handout of material that talks a little bit about our ministry and where it is that we're going. And, you know, our mission is articulated in this handout, and then a little bit of the vision for our history, where it is we've come from over the last several years. And then there's something of our vision for the future, the plan that we have in place, and I'm not going to read that to you, but I'd like you to have it because we feel like it's important for you to know as you're talking to people within the group of which you're a part. We want you to be knowledgeable about our ministry and what it is that God's doing. But as I shared with you in the invitation that was extended for you to come to this meeting, we're not asking you for money today. That's not our purpose. But I would like to ask you to respond to a question. And the reason that we're bringing you together today and we're bringing other groups like you together over the next several months is to ask you this question. Can you help us, can you help me to understand what it is that we might be able to do to capture the imagination of the people that are part of the group that you represent, in terms of engaging them in the variety of ways which are available to them to become involved as partners with us in fulfilling the mission to which we've committed ourselves to? Can you help me to understand what it is that we can do? And once I was clear, or once I felt confident that message was made clear, that they understood the question, then I'd sit down. And, you know, oftentimes after you sit down, there's kind of quiet. You know, everybody's just kind of not saying much of anything. And people, you start hearing paper shuffling, and people are kind of looking through what it is you've given them. And then eventually somebody will say something. And I can't tell you the number of these kinds of meetings that I've been involved in. But in every instance, you know, there's something that incredibly happens in those meetings that's really quite extraordinary, because they'll tell you exactly what it is that you need to do. They'll tell you that there are people that are not in this meeting that need to be in this meeting because these people are really influential in certain areas. They'll begin to volunteer in terms of, well, I could do this, and you really need to be doing this, and this is a thing that you've not done really, really well. And some people are really offended by some of the things that you've done. They'll tell you all of that. And eventually they'll say, you know, and interestingly enough, and many times they'll say, well, we could do this. And all of a sudden, they'll start taking on responsibility. They'll take some ownership of your problem. Because the realities are, you know, they know what it is that you don't know, and most people are willing to tell you what it is that you don't know in an effort to try to help you to become what it is that you really long to become. And at the end of 2 hours, they say, listen, guys, you know, it's been a great conversation. We made a promise to you. And that is that, you know, this wasn't going to take any longer than 2 hours. So thank you so much for coming and being such a help to us. And then there's something else that I would do, but I'm not going to tell you that because that's part of the little next presentation that I'm going to make here. So there's something else that I would do after that. But then they leave. Well, let's assume that, just for the sake of illustration, that all of them walked into that meeting non-vested D's. Let's just say that that was the group. You know, there was a group of very influential people within a group that we're seeking to, you know, really impact, but they all walked in non-vested D's. How did they walk out? In many instances, they walked out vested B's. they attended something, the very fact that they crossed the threshold and came into the meeting room, you know, they fulfilled the attendance requirement, all right? And many times, and more often than not, they'll choose to become involved in some way in enabling you to accomplish what it is you've committed yourself to do. So exponentially what happened? The likelihood of some point in time in the future of them becoming engaged in the support of your organization. Now, I'm not talking just about financial support. I'm talking about support in the variety of ways in which that could occur. Because not everybody can give you money. But they all could do something. And you need to kind of think what they could do in enabling you to accomplish what it is you've committed yourself to do. The realities are exponentially the likelihood of their becoming involved in the future has gone from 0 to 60% in 1 2-hour meeting. You know, that's pretty nifty. Now, the realities are you don't have to have 6 people or 12 people in a restaurant to have a task force meeting. I mean, you can do it 2-on-1. I do it all the time. There's rarely a time that I'm sitting with someone that I won't turn it into some form of a quote-unquote task force concept meeting. You know, I'll sit down with someone and I'll say, you know, I sat down with wealthy people. I have the opportunity many times to meet some people with some extraordinary wealth. And I've always been very curious about wealthy people in terms of what motivates them to give. And so many times I'll ask them, I says, would you mind if I ask you a question? They say, well, no. Like you, Jerry, I have no agenda other than just really wanting to know. I said, you're pretty well-to-do. At least you're perceived as being pretty well-to-do. And I suspect you get a lot of opportunities to invest in a variety of ministries. Yeah, you wouldn't. And they'll begin to tell you, you wouldn't even begin to understand how many times I get appealed to. I said, I know it must be just lots and lots. And can you help me to understand what it is that, you know, how you evaluate whether or not you're going to support something or not support it? I mean, how do you make those determinations? Because, you know, everybody's expecting and wanting a yes answer, and you can't say yes to everybody. So how do you gauge what it is that you're going to support and not support? I just like to know. Well, you know what? Eventually, most of them will tell me. Because that's one of those little exercises that I do pretty regularly. They say, I only give to people who ask me. Now, essentially what they were saying is, and it all comes out in a variety of ways, but it's only those individuals that eventually somehow face-to-face get to them and ask, you know, present their need and ask them to become involved. I says, well, that's pretty hard to do. You're pretty hard to get to. Well, he says, that's for them to figure out, you know. You know, but the realities are, how are you likely to get to them? If somebody that's hard to get to, how would you be most likely able to get to them? Can you think of a way? That's a question, by the way, I'm posing to you. That's right. You know, somebody with whom, you know, that has linkage with that individual is probably a good way to do it. You know, that you somehow have the opportunity of having this kind of, you know, introduction that may or may not go somewhere. And whether it goes somewhere or not is going to be predicated on another thing that I'm going to be talking about in just a few seconds. Okay. So, you know, think through the task force meeting. I mean, I do it all the time. I mean, literally, get a couple of people together, you know, just sit down. And it's very non-threatening. You're not asking them for anything, so the obligation of, you know, feeling, you know, some level of anxiety because I'm going to ask this person for $100,000 and I can't even say $100,000, you know, that's really hard for me to say. I mean, you know, it's you're just asking for information. But so often we have meetings and they don't go anywhere. You know, we just basically have these meetings and, you know, nothing ever really tangible comes out of it that's meaningful from a developmental standpoint. Well, see, that's very, very meaningful. We have organizations all around the world that are doing task force meetings. And everybody loves them because they're so easy to do. They can be planned. You know, you don't have to, you know, I'm going to have dinner with so-and-so. He's a part of a group of people. You know, he's a doctor. He's been a real supporter of our ministry. You know, he knows who the critical members of the critical group are. How can we work together to try to bring them to a point where they could be exposed to what it is we're doing? You know, and they'll answer the question all the time. People want to be asked. You want to be asked things. In your area of knowledge, you are complemented by someone who recognizes the role that you play in the group of which you're a part and would desire your opinion. You all feel that way. I mean, I know I feel that way. I mean, I like it when somebody asks me my opinion about something that I know about. You know, when they ask me about something I have no idea about, then I usually tell them I have no idea about that. But I'm complimented by someone who would say, Jerry, you know, my pastor will periodically come to me and he say, you know, Jerry, we're getting ready to do this. Can you help me to understand what would be a good way to do it? I said, yeah, I can. Let me share with you two or three things. Many times he'll take that counsel and they'll do it. And, you know, that feels good and I'm glad that I could be a part. But I've taken some ownership in the project by virtue of what it is that he's done as well. And so would be true with the people that you ask as well. So anyway.
If it's a really wealthy person, aren't you not taking opportunity to ask them?
Well, I'm going to talk about that in just a few seconds. There's something else that needs to be done in that meeting that I've purposely avoided because it's my part of my next discussion.
Right.
So, by the way, when we're doing capital funding campaigns, you know, we'll look at AID. We do a lot of, our company does a lot of what's called feasibility studies, and I'm sure that that's a term that most of you are familiar with, but if an organization is getting ready to go into a major campaign, we'll conduct we call it a pre-campaign assessment, but essentially what we're trying to do is we're trying to find out, you know, how much money they could raise. Well, one of the things that we'll do is we'll kind of, you know, look at their database, and we'll try to evaluate and assess, you know, the people that are on their database on the basis of information that they've chosen to preserve, that would help us to understand whether or not they have a predominant number of A or B prospects or a predominant number of C and D prospects. Because you can almost expect that these people are going to support you and these people aren't unless something happens. So this now determines not only predictability in terms of what it is that you could expect, but it also is going to define agenda for what it is that needs to be done. You see, if you look at your database and you see that the preponderance of people in your database are C and Ds, that kind of defines what it is that you need to do developmentally, doesn't it? And so that's pretty important to know. Now, interestingly enough, we do a lot of church campaigns. Now, you would expect that a church campaign, that you'd have a lot of A and B prospects, wouldn't you? Because attendance, involvement, and donation, I mean, hey, listen, who hasn't thrown a dollar into the offering plate, you know, and if they come to church, you know, then all of a sudden, so they're all B's or A's, all right? Not necessarily, because I think you need to redefine those. And so if we're doing a church campaign, you know, we define attendance as somebody who attends church 40 to 52 weeks, you know, a year. In other words, it's more than just, you know, this is my church because I go there every Easter and I've never missed a Christmas service, you know, and I've been to two funerals this year. Oh, okay. I mean, that doesn't necessarily qualify you as a dyed-in-the-wool, deeply committed participant in that congregation. So we would say in order to qualify on attendance, you would have to be there from, you know, 40 to 52 weeks a year. On involvement, it's somebody who understands your mission and who has chosen purposely to partner with you in helping you to accomplish it. In other words, it's not just coming to church and going to Sunday school that would qualify you as being an involved member of a congregation. It's somebody who clearly understands the mission and that they have a gift and they have a role in enabling you to accomplish it. So and according to, you know, statistics in the United States, which I realize are perhaps different than they are in your country, but in the case of the United States, basically George Barner, who has written a lot about statistics, and some of you are familiar, I'm sure, with his writings, you know, he says that it's about 10 to 12% of the people who attend church on Sunday morning, you know, who are essentially, you know, really bought into the mission to the extent that they really are involved and have chosen to become a part of enabling you to accomplish it. Now, when you get down to donation, it's not just somebody that puts a dollar in the offering plate. It's somebody who tithes. Now, tithing, you know, in Barner research has been defined in two different ways. One definition of tithing is somebody who gives 10% or more. Another definition of tithing is that people have a pattern for giving. In other words, I've been giving $20 a month and I've been doing it every year for the last 37 years, and so, hey, listen, I'm a tither. Well, depending upon how you define it, if you're defining it as 10%, it's less generally than 8% of the people who attend church on Sunday, you know, are tithers. If you're looking at people, you know, who have a pattern for giving, it could go as high as 30 or 35%. So, and usually there's not an awful lot in between, okay? So it depends on how you, but so again on donation, you know, so now you're looking at a congregation where you might think intuitively that the majority of people in the congregation are A prospects. Well, you may have a majority of the people that are C or maybe even D prospects that are on your church rolls. But most churches don't know that, and so there are no efforts to try to move them up from D's to C's to C's to B's and so forth, because we don't have a plan. We just kind of live with what it is that we have, and that's how most organizations are managed. But imagine if we became a little bit more strategic about it, how more impacting our ministry might be with people on our database as a nonprofit parachurch organization that many of you represent, or as a congregation. For those of you that may be working in congregational ministries, we're all part of a congregation, aren't we? Regardless of whether or not, you know, we represent a congregation in the context of our presence here at Shopron. So this is all cultivation. And we need to have the assurance. I mean, I love to do what it is that I do, because rarely do I walk into situations where I don't expect somebody. In fact, I always expect somebody to say yes, which is kind of the point of my next illustration. Oh, my next point. Sue accuses me periodically. She says, you know, Jerry, she says, you live in your own world. I says, I know, honey, you ought to come in sometime. It's a great world that I live in. I just love my world. I just kind of live there. I spend a lot of time in my world. It's a delightful place to be. Well, let me tell you something. In my world, Jerry has never, ever expected anybody to say no. I have never in my life expected anyone to say no, ever. Now, people have said no to me, and I'm going to tell you why that doesn't bother me, because this is the next model that I'd like to share with you, and this is going to be the last one that we're going to do today. You guys have done really, really well. I mean, this has been a long seminar. Some of you are really tired. You look really tired. Some of you look really bad, actually. You look exhausted. So I'm glad that you're here and you've endured this long. That's really encouraging to me. But let me, I'm going to share with you this next illustration, and I'm here to tell you that this could revolutionize your ministry. So if you're tired and if you just feel like you're not going to be able to handle it, stand up. You know, and yeah, there you go. Stand up on the corner. That's fine. That's not a problem, because I don't want you to miss this. Because missing this would be like missing, you know, the whipped cream. Boy, I guess if we have more people tired. Some of you were the ones that I thought looked really bad. So, oh, there we go. We got another one. All right, now that's better. Don't feel embarrassed at all, because I have to do that periodically as well. That's why I'm standing up here, because I'm exhausted too. No, that's not true. I was speaking not too long ago someplace, and after I got done, somebody came up to me and they said, you know, Jerry, I heard you speak 25 years ago. I says, oh, great. I says, do you remember a thing that I said? And they said, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. And he took out a napkin and he drew the diagram I'm going to draw for you now. He says, that changed my life. He says, my ministry changed when I understood the implications of what it is that you just shared. And I'm here to tell you that it can change your life as well. So let me give you the illustration. That's a C, okay? I'm going to call that the C of prospects. And in the C of prospects is virtually every resource that we would ever need in order to be able to accomplish what it is that God's called us to do. Every resource that we would need is in the C of prospects, and it's there in abundance. All the prayer partners we'll need are in the sea of prospects. All the volunteers we'll need are in the sea of prospects. All the clients we'll ever need are in the sea of prospects. All the dollars we'll ever need are in the sea of prospects. All the in-kind contributors are in the sea of prospects. I mean, it's there. They're there, and they're there in abundance. Okay? They're all in the sea of prospects. Now, here in the middle of the sea, there's an island. And on that island, there's a beautiful building. And that beautiful building represents your ministry. And it's fun to hear you talk about your ministries. I've enjoyed hearing you tell me about what it is that you do and the passion that you have for what it is that God's called you to do. You see, you've been inside the house, haven't you? You've been inside that house and you've seen the difference that is being made by the work that you're doing. You've seen people come in who, you know, in the time that they entered the house, you thought there was just absolutely no hope whatsoever. You've seen students come into, you know, chapter meetings, and you've seen people walk into evangelistic crusades, and when you see them walk in, you're thinking, oh my word, Lord, what in the world are you about to do? And you just become, you know, discouraged perhaps, and then you see God do something. And your heart leaps with joy because all the things that you know God can do, He's done. And He's done it in such a marvelous and a miraculous way. And the reason that you're here today, the reason that you're sitting in this seminar, the reason that you sacrificed to the degree that you did to come to Shopron was because you know what's happening in the house, your house. Now, the challenge that we face, however, is that everybody down here in the Sea of Prospects, you know, many of them have never even, don't even know that the house exists. And many of them that know the house exists have never been inside the house. They don't know what it is that the Lord's doing there. And so, you know, something needs to happen. And so there are three things that actually need to happen. The first thing is represented by this arrow. And I call it the entry-level opportunity. And the entry-level opportunity, figuratively speaking, is whatever opportunities that we might be able to provide that would bring people out of the sea of prospects and bring them right up here to the front porch of the house. I mean, you need to think through, you know, how can I bring people to the front porch and expose them to who it is we are and what it is that we're all about? Now, let me explain what happens when people come to the front porch of the house. They kind of walk up to the front porch, and what do? We open the door, don't we? And we open the door and we allow people to kind of peer in and to see what it is that's inside the house. You know, we may have one of our students, you know, that'll stand up and just give a testimony and say, listen, I came to this ministry and, you know, I was a depraved high schooler, you know, that came to the university, and I was committed to pursuing my depravity until I met, you know, a guy from the Evangelical Student Union, and man, he says, I was invited to a meeting and it was a debate, and I came and they begin to tell their story of their remarkable conversion, you know, and you're sitting there and you're listening to that testimony, and essentially you're getting a picture of what it is that happens in this house. Or I came to a retreat. Testimonies and anecdotes are wonderful ways to expose people to what it is that's happening. And maybe they come to a, you know, there are a variety of things. A person speaks on behalf of your organization, and by doing so, kind of essentially brings the front porch to them. You can either bring people to your front porch, or you can bring the front porch to them. In other words, you could go to a group, you could go to a church, and you could kind of share with people what it is that's happening in the house. But typically what happens when that meeting is over is we close the door. All those people that came into the front porch kind of meander back down into the sea of prospects. And so it's a, you know, the realities are, in the case of most of your ministries, and this is going to be disturbing to some of you because I think you'll recognize it as being true, that in the case of most of your ministries, you have brought thousands, in some cases tens of thousands of people to the front porch. You've left them there. That's tragic. You know, all these people have been exposed to your ministry. They've all been exposed, and you've brought them to the front porch, and you've left them there. Well, you know, if you came to my front porch, and I hope that you will, this happened at Shopron last year. I can't tell you, well, I could, because it's not that many, I guess, but there's probably been four or five people that have, you know, were in Shopron last year that have ended up on my front porch in Indianapolis. If you're in the U.S., I hope that you'll come to my house. We would love to entertain you. We would love to have you stay. We will bring people from our church. I've developed a reputation now. Whenever somebody comes in from, when Tim comes over to the United States, he's going to come to my house, see? And we'll bring in, you know, 50, 60 people for lunch someday, and we'll just sit down, we'll talk to Tim. So if you come, I promise you, I'll give you a meeting with, you know, as many people as I can bring together. I make really good ice cream, and people in my church, they love my ice cream. So I say, I'm going to have an ice cream social, and oh, by the way, Tim McMahon's going to be there from the UK, represents a ministry in Russia that's ministering to Muslim people, and we'll have a whole lot of people there. Well, okay, so Tim, I could bring the front porch to them. Not everybody's going to be able to go to Kazan and see the Eurasian Bible Institute or the Eurasian Bible College, but Tim can share with us what it is that's happening there. Now, if Tim came to my front porch and he knocked at the door and I opened the door and there's Tim, I said, well, Tim, for crying out loud, what in the world are you doing here in Indianapolis? He said, well, Jerry, you said stop by. And, you know, I think Sue's a figment of your imagination. So I just like to meet Sue. Well, what's the next thing I'm going to say to Tim? I'm going to say, come on in. Now, I want you to watch this because this is very, very important. The most important thing you've heard today, because here I am standing on the front porch. There between the front porch and the foyer is a threshold. The moment Tim lifts his foot to cross the threshold into the foyer, the relationship changed. You see, it may have been emotion that brought him to the front porch, but it will always be rationalism that will bring people into the foyer. Relationships are built in the family room. That's where relationships are built. They're not built on the front porch. You want people to come into the house. We call that process that brings someone from the front porch into the foyer, we call that process bridging. And think of a bridge as anything to which you have to say yes or no to. It's an invitation, right? And yes and no are rational decisions. Yes, I would like to come in. No, I can't come in. Now, so the step one of this procedure is providing the entry-level opportunity. Step two is creating the bridge. And step three, which isn't really a step at all, it's the result of a successful bridge, and that's called conversion. And conversion is always a percentage. If you brought 100 people to the front porch and 50 people said yes to your invitation to come in, you had a 50% conversion rate. You need to track conversion percentages in conjunction with everything that you do. You just must do that. So you always try to determine how many people came to the front porch, how many people responded to the bridge. Now, you're saying, okay, Jerry, I think I'm beginning to understand that, but I need to have some help on bridging. So let me give you some examples on bridging, okay? Let's say Tim comes to my house, and we do with Tim what it is that we were certainly willing to do with you and anybody that comes to our home, but we give him an opportunity to talk to some of our friends who love the Lord and really believe in missions, and we just really want to expose them to all the opportunities that are available, because oftentimes many of these people just don't know. And so Tim, you know, speaks, you know, on behalf of Eurasian Bible Institute or Bible College, and so let me be Tim, and you be the people sitting in we have a little conference room where we do a lot of, you know, we just bring people up where we do a lot of our training in our ministry. And so let's say that, you know, I'm Tim, and I'm saying, you know, this is what it is we do, and he talks about the ministry. And now the meeting's coming to a close, okay? And, you know, thanks for, you know, Jerry, for providing me the opportunity to be here with all of you. And you've heard a little bit about our college and what it is that the Lord's doing. It's just so exciting because, you know, God's making a huge difference. We have 15 students at our school. Our annual operating budget for our college is $60,000. $60,000. That's what it costs us to do. And we are taking on the 1040 window. We're just really asking God to give us, you know, a huge number of people who respond in faith to the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ through our graduates and our students that are going out to the Islamic world. And oftentimes when I come to meetings like what Jerry's provided for me here, oftentimes, you know, I'm asked, how can I be a part of what it is that God's doing, you know, in Kazan and Kazakhstan? How can I be a part of that? So let me just share with you 5 or 6 ways that you could be a very integral part of what it is that God's doing in our ministry. First of all, you know, we send out via fax, or not via fax, but via email. We call it a VIP newsletter. If you're interested in our ministry, guess what? You're a very important person to us. And we have this little newsletter that comes out. It's something that you can digest in about 30 seconds. But it talks about the need. It talks about what it is that's happening around the Islamic world. It talks about how and we've strategized to address that need. And if you'd like to receive that, we would love to send it to you. It comes via email. And if you'd like to receive it, you just check on the little box of the card that's provided for you there in the front of the in the brochure that I handed you. And we would be more than thrilled to send you that. And number two, we have a prayer partners network. If you'd like to, you know, we're asking the Lord this year for 10,000 people all throughout the world to take on the responsibility of praying for what it is that God's doing in Kazakhstan. and around the world as a result of our ministry. And if you'd like to be a part of that Prayer Partners Network, we'd love to send you a 30-day prayer guide. You know, we can send it to you in a magnet form that you can put on your refrigerator door. If you'd like to pray for us, just let us know. And we'll send you periodic email updates in terms of special prayer requests, special needs that we're really seeking the intervention of God in, and things that come up that we just can't predict, you know, by producing a something that's distributed in the way that this magnet is. So we'll keep you up. If you'd like to do that, then just check there. You know, number three, we have a student sponsorship program. Do you realize that most of our students come from some of the outlying provinces in the former Soviet Union? We pay their way to get them to school. You know, we have to help pay their tuition, and we're not part of that. That's part of our budget. And if you'd like to sponsor a student for a day or a week or a month, and it's outlined what that would represent in terms of dollars, and to pray for that person, we'll make sure you get a picture of them and so forth. If you'd like to be one of our student sponsors, we'd love to have you to do that. Number four, we have a quarterly newsletter. You know, you may want to take a look at that newsletter. We've brought several copies here that you can look at. Anecdotally, it tells a story of what it is that God's doing in the lives of people. We love to share those stories. And if you'd like to receive our newsletter so you can kind of be on the cutting edge of what it is that the Lord's doing, you know, in our school, we'd love to have you do that. Number five, you know, we're seeking to establish kind of a presence in every, you know, evangelical church where God gives us the opportunity of speaking on behalf. And you'd like to kind of be a coordinator in your church, or you'd like to be somebody that would, you know, just kind of make sure that, you know, these literature, this is distributed and so forth. And we'd love to have you consider doing that. If you have an interest in being the coordinator in your church, and just check there, we'll make sure you get the information and just talk to you about ways that you could just kind of keep the message in front of people in your congregation about what it is that's happening in Kazakhstan. You know, number six, you know, every year in March, we have a special tour where we bring people to Kazakhstan to actually give them the experience of seeing what it is that the Lord's doing. It's something that happens over basically a long weekend. And I realize that sounds rather strange, but we ask people usually they leave on Thursday and they come back on Sunday. It gives them 3 days in Kazakhstan. We keep the cost low and whatever. But if you'd like to get information about that trip, we'd love to have you come and be a part of it, because it's been a revolutionary and life-changing for me. And many of you have never had the experience. And if you want to stay on longer, you can. But the realities are we've tried to accommodate the schedules of busy people so that they have the opportunity in a cost-effective way to get out there and to really see what God is doing. Now, let's just say that I think I shared six things. If anybody checked anything on the card that you gave them, what have they done to your invitation to come in? They said yes, didn't they? You see, you know, would you like to come in? Yes. You know, receive the email newsletter? Yeah, I'd like to do that. So what have they done? They've crossed the threshold and they come into the foyer. Now, there's a couple things that I want you to remember about what it is that I just did with you. Number one, I provided a multiplicity of bridges. I mean, I gave you six opportunities to say yes. You see, I want you into the foyer. I want to be able to begin building a relationship with you, but I can't do it between the foyer and the front porch. I want you to come in and, you know, come into the family room. Let's sit down and have milk and coffee together and talk about what it is that God's doing in our lives. I mean, that's where relationships are really built. So I provided you six opportunities. And the other thing that I am suggesting is that you want to keep the threshold low. I mean, I could say, you know, in order for us to be effective in our ministry, we need 10 people that will give us $6,000 this year. Maybe you'd like to be one of those. Well, I mean, if that's the only thing that you said, I mean, you need a pole vault to get over that, you know, threshold. I mean, the realities are, you know, the goal is you want them in the foyer. See, that's the bridge. Let me tell you something. There are two assumptions that we make in ministry, and both of these assumptions are wrong. And to the degree that you understand this, it could change your whole ministry. There are two assumptions that we make, and these are the two assumptions that we make that are wrong. The first one is that when you say something, everybody gets it. If you believe that, you've never had a teenager live in your house. I mean, if you believe that just because you said it and you said it once that everybody gets it, then that's wrong. You know that that's not true. I mean, my boys, I raised two sons. I mean, the fact that they're alive is really quite amazing. But, you know, they're 36 and 34 right now, or 37 and 35 or something, but they're old. And you know, when they were teenagers, they would do some really stupid things. And I can remember looking at them and I said, if I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times, never, ever do that. And they're acting like they're hearing it for the first time. You said something about that, Dad? I don't really remember. And you just want to kind of send them off to the highlands of the moon or something. But the realities are, you can't assume that when you say something about your ministry that everybody gets it. The other wrong assumption that we make, and which is even more critical in many respects, and that is this, that even if you said something, and let's just assume for the sake of illustration that they did understand what it is that you said, you cannot assume that they are going to take the energy that it requires to know how to act upon what it is you just told them. You see, most people probably could figure out that you need prayer, but they probably never will pray for you. Most people would probably know that, you know, they could do something in their church to represent your organization. But the realities are they're probably not going to do that. I mean, they're not going to take the energy to try to figure it out. Stop and think about yourself. I mean, I think pastors are notorious for not bridging. Let me give you an example. My pastor just preached a great message a few months ago on fasting. It was a terrific message. It really was. I can't remember how many messages I've heard. I think probably it was the very first one I've ever heard on fasting. You know, the whole focus of the sermon was on fasting. And I took a lot of notes, and I was pretty impressed with the message. And Sue and I are driving home from church. And I looked at Sue as we were driving home, and I said, honey, how many people do you think in our church are going to fast this week? She said, oh, probably not very many. And I said, yeah, I think you're right. Now, if Tom, that's the name of our pastor, I said, if Tom had done this, and run through a scenario, but if Tom had done this, I'd like you to respond to that question again. Let's suggest that Tom, you know, finishes his message. And he says, you know, we've talked a lot about fasting. You've seen the role that fasting has played, you know, throughout the scriptures in drawing people to God in very, you know, meaningful times and at significant times in their life and in their walk with Him. And perhaps, you're hearing some of this for the first time, or you've kind of passed over it as you've read it in the scriptures. And maybe some of you aren't ready to take on a 40-day fast right now. And you know something? I'm not either. But let me share with you something. I'd like to share with you some ideas that I hope that God would use to challenge you as it relates to this very important discipline, the spiritual discipline that God has provided for us. You know what I'd like to have you all consider doing? Is I'd like you to consider in the next week is not eating a meal that you would normally eat. I'd like you all to, and I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand to do that, but I'd like you all to consider doing that. And here's what I've done. In the church bulletin this week, I've made some suggestions. If you would be willing to do that, this is what it is I'm asking you to do. Number one, when that mealtime comes, what I'd like to encourage you to do is to go someplace where you can be totally alone. Now, if you're working in a factory, maybe the only place you can go is to your car out on the parking lot. But then go there. But try to go someplace where you can be totally alone for at least a half an hour, maybe 40 minutes. Here's suggestion number two. I have written down four passages of Scripture. Each of them have 12 to 14 verses in them. And what I'd like you to do is when you go to that private place, I'd like you to take a watch with a second hand. And when you sit down in that private place, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to just open up your Bible and read, you know, each one of those passages. But after you read one and read it thoughtfully and meditatively, and when you've read one, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to press the, or take 5 minutes, you know, press the chronograph or whatever, you know, but take 5 minutes and not say a word. Just allow God to permeate your heart and your mind. You know, in our society, you know, the realities are we talk a lot to God, but we don't listen too much to Him. And I think, you know, one of the things that fasting does is it allows us the opportunity of really listening to God. And so I'd really encourage you to just listen to God. And ask God what it is that He would like to share with you and to teach you about Himself from that passage of Scripture. And after 5 minutes is over,
then read the next passage and so forth. I'd like you to do that. And one more thing. If this is a meal that you normally eat, you know, guess what? Your tummy is going to be sending messages up to your brain saying you forgot something, okay? You're going to feel the urge. You're going to feel the hunger. You're going to feel the urge for food, the desire for food. And I want you to recognize that for what it is. It's just a normal desire. You normally eat at this time, and your body's telling you that. But I'd like you to just take a moment to try to think about the desire that you're feeling and allow your mind to transfer that to God and imagine, just try to imagine the incredible desire He must have had for you that would cause Him to forsake His Son on the cross of Calvary. Just allow yourself to think that. So I'm explaining this to Sue as we're driving home. I says, what would you do in that case? And she says, Thursday. Thursday lunch. I mean, see, the point is, it's a bridge, isn't it? You can't assume that everybody that heard that message is going to figure out, well, now I could take off Thursday, I could take off a lunch. I don't have to go on a 40-day fast. We can't assume that people are going to take the energy to do that. The realities are we are being bombarded in our society by people who want us to respond to things. You know, be it the pastor from the pulpit, being the television advertiser, being the billboards, you know, along the side of the road as we drive down the highways, you know, all of which are asking us to assume, to take the energy to figure out how we could take advantage of what it is that they have to offer. And the reality is that none of us, we're just programmed against it. And so the realities are what the bridge is it provides the steps that people need to take in order to be able to respond and to be a part of what it is that you can do. Now, you know, when people don't, you know, in Jerry's world, as I was kind of sharing with you, in Jerry's world, everybody's always, nobody wants to say no to Jerry. But, you know, in the context of 35 years of doing this, a lot of people have said no to me. But you know what my conclusion is? I didn't give them enough opportunity to say yes. Because who would want to say no to Jerry? But the point is, and I know a part of that's, you know, naivete or just plain stupidity, you might say. But the point is that we need to bridge, and we need to bridge absolutely everything. If you're sitting down with somebody over lunch and talking about your ministry, let me share with you a couple of things I'd like you to pray about. Would you be willing to pray about a couple of things as it relates to our ministry? And urge them to say yes or no. I mean, give them the opportunity of being able to respond to you. Here are two things that I'd like you to pray about. And if you don't mind, in a week or two, I'd just like to give you a buzz and just see if, you know, God has given you any insight as it relates to these particular prayer requests or whatever. I mean, the realities are, you know, most often we go out of meetings and people say, well, how was the meeting? You say, well, it was good. Well, you think that, you know, people are going to be interested in doing, you know, involved in what it is we're doing? Yeah, I think they will. And you may have every reason to think that they might because they responded to you in ways, and I'm not suggesting that you were wrong, but they never do anything. And they never do anything because you never bridge them. It is the greatest mistake that is made in development today is the failure to bridge at every level. We just simply do not bridge. And you don't have to ask for money to bridge. I'm not suggesting, I mean, I gave you, I think, one way that you could give money in the case of Kazakhstan, but the realities are you could have six bridges and none of them involve money, but it still moved people forward in the relationship. So, the three most important questions of development. I gave you the first one already. The first one is, how do I create linkage with somebody with whom I don't have it naturally? All right, that's the first of the three most important questions of development. You've got to answer that question. You just must answer that question. Now, number two question that you must answer is what kind of entry-level opportunities can I provide to bring people to the front porch? How do you get people to the front porch? Can I bring them to my front porch? Do I go to their front porch? But how can I bring people and expose them to the nature and the dimensions of what it is that God's called me as an organization to do? You need to answer that question. What kind of entry-level opportunities are you providing to expose people to the full dimensions of the ministry to which God's called you? And the next question, the third most important question of development, is what kind of bridges can I create? How can I move them from the front porch into the foyer? Not everybody is going to say yes.
Not everybody's going to say yes. But virtually no one will say yes if you don't give them the opportunity. Think about evangelism. In Transforming Culture, one of the stories that I tell in Transforming Culture, actually it's an allegory. It's just two people talking to each other. I'm pretty simple-minded. And have to. I teach telling stories and I write telling stories, so you'll forgive me for that. But in Transforming Culture, there are two predominant characters in the book. One is a journalist who is investigating a church that is apparently making a huge difference and impact in the culture of the world, the community of which they're a part, much more significantly than any other church that ever has been known to do. And so the journalist is talking to the pastor. Well, the pastor tells a story of a man in his church, a physician, who is a very prominent physician, and a physician, and one of the things that the church had, in seeking to reach out to their community, they identified the critical groups. Who are the critical groups of people? If we're going to really impact our community and claim our community for Christ, what groups of people would we perceive as being strategically critical to our ability to be able to do that? With whom we have some linkage within our congregation. Well, in this particular case, the medical community was identified. So now the question is, well, what kind of entry-level opportunities can we provide? Well, this one physician figures out that people in the medical profession, the one thing that people in the medical profession become, and our doctor friend from Sydney here can help us, but a lot of them that are in like oncology or something like that, they become cynical. Because they can't grapple with tragedy. The very fact that 90% of the people that walk into their office or 99% of the people that walk in their office are going to die. So how do you keep hopeful and how do you keep positive in difficult situations? And this doctor recognized that. So under the auspices of the church and the Catholic hospital that he was associated with, they offered a special seminar that was called How to Keep Hope in a difficult situation. Well, it was, this doctor is very, very prominent. People from all over the hospital come to this seminar that was held at a very convenient time for them. And so the presentation is made. And it's not blatantly Christian, but it certainly has, a Christian message to it. And then, the bridges are created. Once a month we're going to have, meetings in the cafeteria, support group meetings. And if you'd like to be a part of those, then check here. If you'd like to know more about other seminars that are forthcoming, then check here and so forth. And check here and check here and check here. Well, let me tell you, this attitude that we have in terms of evangelism as far as church is concerned, here's the church, this beautiful church. The majority of us, church members or a lot of church members expect that, the heathen down here is going to, come right up into our front door, walk into the front door and just immediately hear the claims of the message of the gospel and is going to say yes. And so that's where evangelism needs to occur. Let me tell you something. There are about four other doors before he ever gets to that door that he needs to walk through, many times before he's ever going to walk through this door. So one of the questions that the journalist asked the pastor in the book, is the journalist says, well, he talks about bridging and the things that they do to bridge people. And the guy says, well, not everybody's going to respond to a bridge. The pastor says, that's right, but hardly anybody will, if any, if you don't create the bridge. And that's the point. But bridging is an important part of this process of moving people into relationship. And so answer those three questions, and I can assure you that life, if you've not been doing those things, that life's going to change for you from a developmental standpoint. How do you create linkage with someone with whom you don't have it naturally? What kind of entry-level opportunities can you provide critical groups that you recognize as being critical to your success? And how can you bridge more effectively? What kind of bridges can you create? Now, later on in the week, I'm going to be talking about, there's really a science in creating bridges. It's almost an art form. And I'll walk you through how you'd go about doing that. But hopefully today has been helpful as kind of a beginning to all of this. And you've been very gracious. You've listened to me, and you haven't fallen off asleep, and none of you have fallen to the floor in total exhaustion. And Dorothy's going to come. I'm going to finish this here, but Dorothy's going to come and just take a few minutes of time to ask you to do something before you leave.